You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning or wherever you are. Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel, Director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy. I'd like to welcome you to the 10th Annual Municipal Finance Conference, jointly sponsored by the Hutchins Center, the Rosenberg Institute of Global Finance at the Brandeis International Business School, the Olin Business School at Washington University in St. Louis, and the Harris Public Policy School at the University of Chicago. This year, we are spreading the conference over 3 days, today, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Hopefully next year, we'll be together in person. Today, we're going to focus mainly on the impact of COVID-19 on state and local finances and the municipal bond market. Tomorrow, on Tuesday, we're going to focus on recent developments in the muni bond market. And then on Wednesday, we are going to have a focus on state and local infrastructure and how it's financed. You can participate in this conference by posing questions on Slido, SLI.do. If you put in the hashtag MuniFinance, it's kind of like Twitter. You send us a question, we'll see them, and where possible, we'll pass them along. Before we turn to today's session, I just want to mention that Wednesday afternoon at 1:30, we're planning some discussion groups that are open to everybody, one on state and local sector fiscal issues and one on the municipal bond market. The Zoom links for those are on the website for this conference, as are the text of the papers, the slides, and eventually the videos will be there as well. I'm now going to turn the program over to my colleague and friend from Brandeis, Dan Bergstresser, who's going to moderate the first panel. I'll be back at 2:15 with a panel to discuss state and local fiscal issues. So over to you, Dan.
Great. Thanks for coming. We will have four papers this morning. Each of these four paper blocks, the authors are going to have 15 minutes. Discussants will have 10 minutes, and then we'll have Q&A for 10 minutes. And so please go online to the Slido site to submit any questions that you have or comments that you have for that Q&A part of the event. The first paper is by Huixin Bi and Blake Marsh of the Kansas City Fed. Dr. Marsh will be presenting this paper. Brad Wendt of Charles River Associates will then have 10 minutes to discuss it. The first two papers will be presented back to back, and then we'll have a 10-minute break, and then we'll have the second two papers after that. So without any further ado, I'd like to turn it over now to Dr. Marsh to present the first paper.
Hey, thank you very much. So thanks for the intro. It's my pleasure to join you all today. I'm going to be presenting joint work with my colleague at the Kansas City Fed, Huixin Bi, today. And I want to thank the organizers for having us and our discussant for what I'm sure will be helpful comments. So as a Federal Reserve employee, the usual disclaimers apply, which I'm sure you've all heard. These are my own views and not the views of the Kansas City Fed or the Federal Reserve System. So I want to start by examining some of the dynamics that affected the muni market in March 2020. So on the one hand, there was a broad financial panic. So March 2020 was characterized by a dash for cash, some call it. And during this time, trading conditions across financial markets became stressed. So even typically safe asset markets like treasuries and munis experienced distress. And in short, across financial markets, selling conditions became strained and market liquidity dried up. So these conditions, we believe, led liquidity premia to increase sharply on muni bonds. But on the other hand, state and local governments were also on the front lines of fighting COVID-19. So COVID required SNLs to deploy more resources, which of course requires more revenue. But because of the panic and the economic shutdown, revenue projections were declining. So for two examples, business activity was contracting. So the tax base was at risk of shrinking through business failures and otherwise. And then among households, joblessness was rising, which raises the possibility that tax obligations could actually be in arrears. And so these conditions lead to concerns about default risk rising for SNL muni issuers. And the confluence of the two, the credit factors and the liquidity factors, caused bond yields to rise very sharply during mid-March 2020. So in response to the financial panic and just the general disruption of economic activity, federal authorities took bold steps to buoy the economy. So the Federal Reserve embraced its lender of last resort role and engaged in aggressive monetary policy. On the U.S. fiscal side, the U.S. government enacted policy support measures, and many of these actions indirectly supported muni markets, and in fact, some of them directly targeted muni markets. And so I want to discuss a few of these in turn, paying careful attention to the timeline here, which is going to factor into some of our later analysis. So around the third week of March, the Federal Reserve introduced the Money Market Liquidity Facility, or the MMLF. So this facility accepted securities held by money funds in exchange for short-term loans. And on March 20th, the eligible collateral set was expanded to include certain municipal bonds. And then it was expanded again on March 23rd to accept variable rate demand notes. And the purpose of this facility was to provide liquidity support to one of the large institutional holders of muni bonds. So around the same time, between March 23rd and March 27th, congressional negotiations were also taking place over the CARES Act. So indirectly, the CARES Act provided support to state and local governments, indirectly to the muni bond, provided support to state and local governments, as well as businesses and households. So this helps support the tax base, but it also provides funds directly to those local governments so they don't have to rely on external financing, perhaps. But more directly to the CARES Act, or more directly to the muni bond, the CARES Act authorized the creation of the municipal lending facility. So this facility was administered by the Federal Reserve, backed by the U.S. Treasury, and the facility was authorized to purchase relatively short-term bonds directly from muni issuers. So the Fed actually becomes, in this case, a buyer of last resort, which is quite unique. So what we want to do in this paper is we want to ask a very fundamental question about the muni bond pricing dynamics during this time. And so, you know, first we want to know how investors reprice these credit and liquidity risks, but more directly to the interventions, we want to know how did they affect the pricing dynamics. So, of course, understanding credit liquidity risk is a very fundamental thing in a bond market, in any bond market, but trying to separate the two components is a difficult task to do empirically. And so what we want to do is use a fairly parsimonious framework. And so we're going to rely on pre-refunded bonds to try to gauge liquidity risk in the market. And this is a somewhat commonly used technique in the literature. So just as a refresher, a pre-refunded bond is a bond. So you issue a refunded bond. Those proceeds are stored in a treasury-backed escrow account. The cash flows mimic the bond payments on the pre-refunded bond. And so the pre-refunded bond essentially becomes fully collateralized. It shouldn't be subject to any credit risk, but it is subject to liquidity risk. And so we can get a sense of the credit risk premium by comparing the spreads on the pre-refunded and the non-pre-refunded bonds. So our research design is going to rely on comparing the pre-refunded, non-pre-refunded bond spread before the intervention and after the intervention. If we see higher pre-refunded bond spreads after the intervention, that tells us that investors are pricing in some sort of credit risk premium more so than they would have before the pandemic. So before I move into the actual results and the modeling, I want to try to highlight our main result just using very simple plots of average yields from our sample. So the highlighted portion on this slide shows that prior to the financial panic and the interventions, the pre-refunded bonds, so the period is shaded by gray, the pre-refunded bonds, which are shown in orange, had the lowest yields among traded bonds, which reflect their lack of credit risk. The short-term bonds, which are shown in green, had a slightly higher yield, which we think reflects a non-zero credit risk premium above the pre-refunded bonds. And then the longer-term bonds have the highest yields, which reflects the credit risk compared to the pre-refunded, but because they're long-term bonds, there's also some interest rate and inflation risk compared to the short-term bonds. So we think there's some term premium component in the blue line. So on this slide, we've highlighted the segment that shows the height of the market panic. So between the time spreads are rising and the intervention, the last intervention takes place during March 2020. So we can see first that yields climbed for all three bond types. The pre-refunded bonds in particular increased about three times above their pre-crisis levels, which reflects severe liquidity problems in these markets and financial markets more broadly. The short-term yields in green increased above all the other bond types. And so we think that this does reflect liquidity challenges, but at the same time, the increased premia above the pre-refunded is indicative of heightened credit risk concerns. And we think these might come from two places. So first is that the pandemic in March was perceived to be somewhat temporary, which put increased pressure on short-term debt. But second, there were tax extension deadlines during this time that pushed back revenue collection dates, which makes default on these very short-term notes more likely. And then finally, we can see that long-term bond yields also spike, but it's hard to tell exactly what's going on here just from this picture. So the analysis will help us unravel that. So on this slide, I'm showing a shaded portion that highlights the months immediately after the interventions by the federal government and the Federal Reserve. The most obvious takeaway here is that yields retreated significantly across all three bond types, and our sample ends just at the end of May, so it's not a very long time after the interventions. And we interpret the decline in pre-refunded bonds here as evidence that the interventions address market liquidity concerns. But the yields on short-term bonds also return to more normal pre-pandemic levels, but there's the longer-term bond yields, however, appear to be higher than they were prior to the interventions, prior to the pandemic, which we think likely reflects a lack of policy support toward the longer-term bond market, but also expectations of a longer duration panic. So you have less support and more credit risk. So these plots are illustrative of our hypotheses and our findings, but they don't let us control for bond or issuer characteristics. And ideally, what we want to do is we want to compare bonds that are pre-refunded and non-pre-refunded among similar issuers, similar maturities, and similar dates. And so to do this, we're going to start with a simple event study that compares yields on bonds just before a policy intervention announcement and just after. We're going to use a sample of highly traded bonds so they can be traded on both days. We're going to compare the bond itself before the intervention and after the intervention, and then we're going to take it another step, and we're going to compare the pre-refunded and the non-pre-refunded sample averages to look for credit risk. So the chart on this slide shows the estimated impact of each intervention on muni bond yields for each day, and this is controlling for bond issuer and trade characteristics, and the bars are the 95% confidence bands around the estimate. So what we find here is that there was no immediate impact on yields following the earliest of the Federal Reserve interventions that occurred on March 20 and March 23rd. These are the two left-hand dots. But again, what we're looking for here are very short-term immediate impacts. So these are basically announcement effects. The interventions are so closely clustered together, we have a hard time separating them out over longer periods. But I think what this illustrates is that the scope and the depth of the market turmoil was increasing during this time, since we see these yields increasing even with the market intervention. But later, as we see more positive news about interventions that were going to offer more comprehensive support to the muni market, we find lower yields that fell more immediately on the news. And so, for instance, if we look at the middle three dates, we can see that on March 24th, when the CARES Act agreement was announced between the White House and Senate leadership, so this made it plausible that an agreement was going to be passed, we see a 30 basis point decline in muni yields. A couple days later, on March 26th, the CARES Act actually passes the Senate, which in some respects was its biggest hurdle. So this reduces yields an additional 60 basis points. And then final enactment of the CARES Act on March 27th corresponded with a decline in yields of about 30 basis points. And then finally, on April 9th, we see that the announcement of the Federal Reserve creating the MLF resulted in another 15 basis point decline. So these more direct measures that are pointed toward credit risk seem to have bigger impacts. So we want to look at this directly, though, and see how much credit risk was moving immediately on the announcement. So when we look here at this table for these differential impacts on non-pre-refunded bonds, so we see an additional decline for non-pre-refunded bonds. That would indicate that these interventions had immediate impacts on credit risk. The second row of the table in red shows that among CARES Act events, nearly all of the impact affected bond segments equally, and we don't find any significant impact on bonds that are not pre-refunded. And so we think that the immediate impact of these announcements was to basically return the market to more normal functioning. So what we just did lets us control for important factors, but it's really not set up to estimate these cumulative effects of the intervention. And so to do this, we're going to run a regression that compares pre-refunded bond yields to longer-term and shorter-term yields on each trading day of our sample. And that's going to give us a daily estimate that we can estimate this non-pre-refunded premium, and we can see how it evolves over time. And again, we can control for characteristics of bonds and issuers. So we're going to look at short-term bonds first. The solid line in the plot shows the average yield differential for bonds with less than 1 year of remaining maturity and pre-refunded bonds that don't face credit risk. The blue shading is the 95% confidence band around these average estimates. So what we see here is that the yield differentials compared to non-pre-refunded bonds, they peak during the crisis. So around mid to late March, that's where we see the highest credit premium. But following the interventions, they fall pretty quickly and they fall to more normal levels. So we think this doesn't reflect the improved market liquidity, but it also reflects the fact that the interventions were aimed at short-term bonds because both the direct fiscal transfers increased the probability that issuers could service existing debt, but the MLF also gave issuers a buyer of last resort should they need to roll over debt. So next, we're going to look at the comparison between longer-term non-pre-refunded bonds and pre-refunded bonds. In this case, we see that the yield premium on longer-term bonds actually didn't increase very much, if at all, during the height of the crisis. But after the interventions, we see the differentials rise steadily through the end of our sample. So I think that this reflects two facts. It reflects the fact that longer-term bonds were less targeted by the intervention policies. They were never geared at rolling over long-term debt or addressing short-term debt. But also this realization that the pandemic would be more than a short-term event. So a longer pandemic puts longer-term revenues more at risk. And so with that, I just want to conclude by summarizing our main findings again. So we find that policy interventions, particularly those with fiscal backing, had a substantial impact on muni bond yields, but they seem to be contained to restoring market functioning and reducing liquidity risk premia immediately. But we find little evidence of additional declines on bonds facing credit risk. But over the cumulative period, we find that credit risk concerns shifted during the pandemic. This is consistent both with the nature of the pandemic and the design of the support policies. So specifically, we think credit risk were an important driver of rising short-term bond yields in March 2020, but not longer-term bond yields. But after the interventions that addressed a lot of the short-term bond concerns, we find that credit risk premia fell for those bonds and increased for the longer term bonds, reflecting the longer term nature of the pandemic and the limited support for these bonds. So this concludes my presentation. I'm happy to take any questions and look forward to the discussion.
Great. Thank you very much, Blake. I want to turn it over now to Brad Wendt of Charles River Associates to take 10 minutes to discuss the paper. Brad, I think you're going to need to unmute yourself.
Got it. Blake, if you take your slides down, that'd be great. Super. As the audience probably knows, the advisory committee has the good fortune of reviewing a slew of outstanding papers prior to the conference every year. And when I saw this paper, it's one that really caught my eye because personally I was at the U.S. Treasury at the time serving as a senior advisor to the undersecretary, and myself and Melissa, who's on the next panel, we lived through this very interesting period. And I really don't want to use the term crisis because I think in everyone's heart of heart, it was a liquidity situation, not a credit situation. And when you look at the CARES Act is crucial in terms of an underpinning that Congress put in was no taxpayer dollars would be put at risk, which is diametrically opposed to the 2008 recession. So Blake, you know, with that in mind, is it fair to say that your research shows that in fact, regardless of the ongoing impact on a negative basis, pandemic has had on the world economy, at least the data that you reviewed, that it was really more of a liquidity crisis, even near term, than ever being a credit crisis. Just want to hear your thoughts on that in terms of perception.
Sure. So I think what we're trying to do here is sort of hold the liquidity factors constant. So it's hard to pin down both credit and liquidity at the same time. And so what we've chosen to do here is hold the liquidity factors constant and then look at how credit premia is varying over this period. So we do find evidence that credit risk premia were rising, first for the short term and then for the longer term. But that said, I think if I take signal just from the first graph that I showed, which is just the average spreads, assuming the pre-refunded aren't really facing material credit risk, the fact that those spreads or the fact that those yields rose, you know, 3 or 4 times above what they normally are would be indicative of the fact that there was a very severe liquidity problem. And just, you know, looking at the graph, it seems like at least early on, that was a major, major component of what was happening.
Okay. Once again, the notion that we had two types of policy impact here, fiscal obviously being legislative and then the Federal Reserve being monetary. From your perspective, was one more effective than the other, or is it important that the U.S. government and the taxpayers had both in their back pocket in terms of tools by which to address this, the pandemic crisis, both near term and long term? Just, you know, for the audience, how do you perceive the value of respective fiscal and monetary policy actions?
So I think when I think about which one was more effective, I have to be careful here, right? Not to get myself in trouble. But I think, you know, early on, I mean, the crisis kind of, or the panic sort of came suddenly, right? And the Federal Reserve had tools that they had used in the previous great financial crisis, and they used those tools quickly. But I think, like you said, you know, everybody is concerned about risk to the taxpayer and credit risk to the institution and so on and so forth. And so, you know, historically, I think central banks have been reluctant to step in and take credit risk in the midst of a panic. It's just about sort of getting the market flowing again, right? And so the CARES Act, you know, it really did two things. I think it relieves those credit risks by just sending money to state and local governments, so they're not relying on the bond markets to potentially raise funding at a time when it's very expensive. But that also helps with, you know, the credit risk perceptions. But it also gives the Federal Reserve a little more latitude to take on credit risk, at least short term. And so, you know, I think that's important to the muni issuers, because if you're concerned about the fact that you may need 30 days or 6 months, say, of financing when you're not collecting revenues, you can just borrow it at a reasonable cost and then repay it when the tax receipts come in. And I don't think that really would have been possible without the backstop provided by the CARES Act.
No, I agree. I think history is such that the backstop really was not necessarily hit that often, if at all. But obviously just the public perception and the general markets perspective that it was available for liquidity and, as you said, backstop. So before reading your paper, and we've obviously had multiple conversations, I think the exciting thing about your paper is it really proves what all of our gut instincts told us on day one. People in the audience lived through the Great Recession of 2008, 2009, 2007, and we knew that was a credit crisis. And obviously no one knew the playbook for a liquidity crisis where it had a long tail on it. And fortunately, the tail seems not to be as long as it could have been. But for you to have gone through the what I would call a 2.5 week period, which people working at the Fed, working at Treasuries, working in the marketplace, I think just seems like a complete blur, and be able to go day by day. I just, you know, want to compliment you on the research you did that really proved what we thought would be the correct tool. But now, at least I think one takeaway in your paper, Blake, And Huixing is the fact that you have a proven toolbox based on the data from the MSRB municipal trade. So just, you know, I want to compliment you, but I just want your thought process on, you know, validity of actually having creating a process by which if a similar situation were to occur that we actually think we know what to do this time, as opposed to we think this should work, but there is never been done in the history of the marketplace for municipals.
I appreciate the, go ahead.
Sorry, I just want to quickly add one comment is that I agree that the liquidity risk certainly is a big component. So like we look at the event study, we show that accumulatively, those lower the liquidity risk by 130 basis points versus later on, we show the credit risk, you know, it changes like 20 basis points. So certainly liquidity risk is a big component. And also the fiscal measures are very important, but also I think it's helpful to put into perspective. The CARES Act is unprecedented in terms of magnitude and the size. So compared to that, you know, the Fed's intervention took the scale is smaller, so I think that also contributes to the very distinct impact, the CARES Act versus the direct interventions or indirect intervention from the Fed.
Thank you. Blake, you're going to say something?
Yeah, I'll just take 1 minute to address your last comment and question. So thank you, you know, for the very kind comments on the paper. I think, you know, we do want to be a little bit careful in what we're trying to say that we found here. So Like I said during the presentation, the fact that the interventions are coming along so fast, so it's almost like you have one every day for 2 weeks, you know, we really can't do more than say that, you know, something changed today that was different yesterday. And so, you know, what is the cumulative impact of the Federal Reserve rolling out the money market liquidity facility? You know, I really don't think our analysis can speak to that. But we can say in totality that these policies had a big effect, I think, on the markets they were geared toward impacting.
Oh, sure, I agree with that. My takeaway is if you only had either the Fed or the U.S. Treasury with congressional authorization working on this, if they were independent tools, certainly there would have been a solution which, at least from your data, returned the marketplace to some state of normality within 6 to 8 weeks. So it's once again, I know how much work you put on the MSRB data slicing, dicing, and the data is the data. So I'm very pleased to have this piece of academic research in hand for hopefully no one to use in the future. I mean, we're going to go through another pandemic, but it'll be on the shelf. In fact, we need something similar. So with that, I certainly welcome questions from the audience, and Dan's going to moderate the questions.
Great. And just making sure, Blake, Brad, Huixing, can you guys hear me okay as I'm moderating the questions that are coming in?
Yep.
Inspired by some of the questions that have been put on the Slido platform. So first off, a reminder that we're using the Slido platform to receive questions from the audience. So I think this is a fantastic paper, and I'm grateful for the evidence here. One thing that I wanted to probe on a little bit was when I think of municipal spreads at different maturities, I think of the convolution of four different things. You've got credit, liquidity, but then you have the expected future evolution of tax rates, and then you've got options. You've got a sort of optionality. And I'm curious, you know, can you separate out when you're looking at long-term versus short-term, the impact of changing future expectations of tax rates? And also, did you try looking at measures of spread or option adjusted spread instead of just yield in your work?
So we did look at spreads. All the results kind of stay, you know, we look at a spread reference, so say treasury yields, comparable treasury yields. I think I'm gonna punt the tax expectations question over to Huixing.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. Here that we did not specifically look into the tax expectations, and there is a big literature using the muni bond to do that. That's a really good point. But I guess what we are thinking here is that we are comparing, unless people in the short period of time, they expect the tax rate is going to change compared to in the short run versus in the long run, it's going to be drastically different. Unless that happens, we kind of take that. I guess our assumption is that there is not immediate expectation changes in the short versus the longer run, the tax is going to be very different. But that certainly could, you know, be could be part of credit risk, I guess, what we're trying to capture here, right? We're seeing the liquidity risk is taken care of by the pre-refunded bond, and then whatever left is credit. But to the extent is investor thinks that the state is, has to issue, like raise tax much higher in the longer run, so that could be incorporated in our credit risk here, which we kind of assuming, you know, the short versus the longer run, there's no changes in that expectations. Yeah, that's something certainly we will, that's a really good point, and we should take into considerations.
How would, if you extract from your work, a measure of liquidity stress in this market, you could sort of, you know, separate out kind of, I love looking at the high frequency pre-refunded versus not pre-refunded as sort of an index of liquidity stress. How does that at the high frequency, how does that measure seem to line up with other measures of liquidity stress that people have used when looking at fixed income or other markets? If you compare it to, you know, the treasury on the run, off the run spread, other measures of, you know, the market, high frequency market, price of illiquidity. How do these things line up together?
So just over our very short sample, I mean, you could see from the plot that I showed that the pre-refunded yields were very high, which was kind of our indication of liquidity stress, like I mentioned. But we know at this time that the treasury market functioning had some very severe issues. So if you look at something like a G spread, on off run spread, you know, those were also very high. I guess one thing we still need to kind of figure out is the liquidity risk associated with a pre-refunded bond, because they're backed by these treasury securities, is it actually related to the treasury market itself? Or is this something specific to the municipal bond market that's going on? But, you know, I think at the end of the day, everybody just wanted to be in as liquid cash-like asset as they could get into. And that was driving a lot of this. And I think we're going to hear later about some of the issues that occurred at the money market funds that were holding these as well.
Is there anything, I mean, I realize I'm putting you on the spot a little bit here as somebody who is employed by the Federal Reserve System. Speaking purely for yourself as the authors, is there anything that you would have done differently in the design of the various interventions that the Fed was involved in during this period? If you can answer that.
I can start with that. So I think given the circumstances, I think the Fed has done its best. Of course, we can always learn from this episode going forward, right? Because even say the MLF was backed by the CARES Act, but without the back, without the, you know, the backstop from the Treasury, it's going to be very difficult for the Fed to have that facility to take part of the credit loss. So maybe going forward, I think, and that's the part is that our paper is trying to understand is going forward, how we can deploy this facility in the future when we have another crisis and what a lesson we can learn about it. So I think at a time, at the peak of the crisis, we learned the lessons from the great financial crisis and we used that. And also, as I said, you know, the CARES Act, the size and magnitude is massive, right? So to some extent, it's not quite fair to compare the CARES Act, the announcement impact, to the other Fed intervention in that regard. So I think the Fed has done a really good job on that, but I think certainly there are lessons we can be learned from going forward.
Dan, if I could just add something from my personal experience, having spent 30 years in municipal finance and people knowing I was at Treasury, I myself and Melissa, my Treasury colleague at the time, you know, we feel that no lack of calls in terms of trying to be a receptive ear to the broker dealers who were having substantial inventory problems in terms of carry. And the, you know, the first facility, as everyone knows, was really just a collateral facility for the money market accounts. And that really didn't address the issue. And what addressed the issue was the ability to have the MMLF, the Money Market Liquidity Facility, put in place. And what I'd like to underscore, and that's why I enjoyed reading the paper so much, it proves that it works, was within a 2-week period, it was two people who did it. It was the congressional authorization and the Fed. Without those two components, it would never have been done because of, their respective authorities. So I think, could they have done something different? I don't think they could have done anything different because it worked perfectly. And the startling thing was on, I think it's about page 9 on their charts, was you saw the 60 basis point drop in the CARES Act was passed. And that was due to very specific legislative action, fiscal action, but that action could not have been put in place without the Federal Reserve's full cooperation and assistance. So I think it's really a success story, and the data bears out it was a success story for the municipal marketplace.
So if I can just add, I guess I'll say first, Weishin and I were not involved in designing any of these facilities. So these are purely our comments. Maybe just abstracting from what I said that, this was short-term, long-term is being a little bit unfair. I mean, I think about long-term as sort of the bulk of the muni market is in that 10-year plus type of range, right? It's funding infrastructure and things of that sort. The MLF actually accepted, and they kept changing it through the summer, but they ended up accepting, I think, up to 3-year issuance, which is quite a long time when you think about how long can something sit on a Fed balance sheet before it rolls off or something like that. So, I mean, like Weishin said, I mean, this is very unprecedented, both in the amount of support that was offered, but also the type of support that was being offered.
Another question has come in the Slido form. Did you look for different responses between taxable and tax-exempt bonds? And I apologize, this is similar in spirit to the question that I was asking about taxes, but did you try anything where you sort of separated the sample that way?
Yeah, we took a quick look, but we have kind of like only have 5-month data, so it's kind of difficult for us to slice the data too much. But the majority of the bonds here, we use geo bond, so majority of the bonds is tax exempt in that regard. But we could do a little more digging into the data, but it's just like we are not using like 10-year bond, a 10-year data, right? It's gonna give us a much larger sample for us to slice that.
And this might be the last question that we have time for before we transition to the next paper, but a question has come in the chat. Given that the MLF, that part of things targeted the primary market, do you have thoughts about mechanisms for the flow of, specific mechanisms for the flow of support from sort of primary market to secondary market?
So I think for me, the primary mechanism is in that short-term debt where we saw the credit premium rising during the biggest part, the most, I guess, most acute part of the panic. So if you're concerned about, an entity or an issuer defaulting within the next 3 or 6 months, the MLF gives them a way to basically roll over that debt. And I think that's just what's going on there is that, nobody else wants to buy the issuance, at least the Fed will, and you can pay down the existing issuance. It gives you another 1, 2, 3 years, something like that, to figure out what's going on.
Great. Any last thoughts that you want to give before we transition to the next paper?
Not for me. This was great. I appreciate all the questions, and thanks, Brad, for the discussion and the comments throughout, and Dan for moderating.
Yeah, thank you very much, Weishin, and thank you, Blake, and thanks to Brad for providing a great discussion. I want to transition now. We have the second paper of today's part of the event is by a team of researchers, this time from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. We have Dr. Ben Hyman, who is here to present the work. Melissa Moy of the United States Treasury is going to be the discussant for this work. Again, the timing is going to be the same as we had for the previous paper. We have 15 minutes for the authors. We've got 10 minutes for a discussion, and then we have 10 minutes for Q&A. And reminding you again, you can pose your questions in the Slido forum using MuniFinance as the hashtag. So without any further chat from me, I'm turning it over now to Dr. Hyman from the New York Fed. Ben, you're gonna need to unmute yourself.
Got it, of course. thank you, Dan. So thanks for the introduction. It's a pleasure to be included on the program. And we're really looking forward to your feedback. So similar to the previous paper, our goal in this paper is to study the value of emergency municipal liquidity when government budgets are under extreme distress. And toward this end, we'll be evaluating the extent to which the federal sector's municipal liquidity facility may have impacted not only muni yields, but also the ability of state and local governments to issue new primary debt and recall public sector employees throughout the crisis. So to start off, I wanted to outline some of the exact ways in which we think this crisis may have impacted budgetary planning, which we've sort of talked about a bit already, and have you consider a local government's 2020 calendar year spanning two fiscal cycles. So in a normal expansion year, governments incur expenses throughout this period, but only receive revenue at distinct intervals. And the classic example of this is proceeds from final settlements of state and local income tax returns due on April 15th. But when governments are short of revenue, they often issue short-term anticipation notes, on municipal bond markets to help smooth out the temporary shortfall. So in this example, they might issue a four-month tax anticipation note, or TAN, issued on January 1st, maturing maybe April 30th, that would generate bond proceeds to smooth out the cash flow and would be secured by revenue incoming on April 15th. Now, as we discussed, an income shock like COVID, first and foremost, leads to declines in income receipts both today and tomorrow. So that's going to lead to a decline in the revenue that would normally cover expenses already incurred. But second, as a matter of fiscal policy, the IRS extended the federal tax deadline to July 15th, which meant that the quantity of short-term notes issued on the market also had to increase to match cash flow needs. And this might normally not be such a huge problem, except simultaneously, there was a large financial sell-off of many fixed income assets, munis being just one of them, as investors sought out more liquid and safer positions. And that drove investor demand for munis towards zero, leaving governments largely unable to issue new debt on private markets. So to further highlight these dynamics, the left panel here shows weekly means for the universe of secondary market municipal bond yields, and shows a steep rise leading up to the first federal sector intervention in the muni market on March 23rd, especially among shorter maturity notes. And then after two further MLF interventions, we have a return to sort of relative normalcy after the third intervention, which is the one we focus on in this paper. So we see this both in short-term and long-term markets. And then finally, if you turn to the right, what you see is that this return to market functioning was most pronounced for safer issuers with potentially fewer bonds on the margin of downgrading or defaulting, whereas higher risk bonds like triple Bs remain distressed. So this is sort of an important stylized fact that I want you to hold on to, that I think it's a pattern that our paper can sort of help explain. And so finally, these two plots are probably what we care most about from a real economy perspective. So on the left, we see a clear shortfall in newly issued bonds towards zero relative to historical trend, which is the gray shaded area, but then a reversion and even an overcompensation post-announcements. Then on the right, we plot state and local government employment over a longer time series, which allows us to compare the Great Recession experience to the pandemic, and you see just a much sharper drop with little to no recovery, and that's something that's emphasized in Louis Shiner's work and topic we explore in our paper as well. So what do we do in this paper? We have two related research questions. So our first is more of a program evaluation question in which we ask whether federal sector interventions were effective at restoring market liquidity and to the extent to which these actions sort of pass through to new issuance and public employment outcomes. And our second is sort of related to the previous paper and more academic in nature, is oriented towards sort of getting under the hood of mechanisms. which is, can we learn whether municipalities are liquidity versus credit constrained by randomly providing an emergency liquidity option to differently rated issuers when they're distressed? So our idea here is that a neutral but non-zero response to the option would suggest the relaxing of a liquidity constraint relative to what's available in the current market, whereas a greater response lower down on the ratings distribution would suggest sort of an additional mechanism in which credit risk may become more uncertain for low-rated issuers when faced with a common shock. And so the additional liquidity in some sense hedges against that risk. So to answer these, we're going to take advantage of lending eligibility cutoffs built into the MLF, which was designed to target state and local short-term cash flow needs with last resort lending, but restricts direct lending eligibility to cities above 250,000 in population and counties greater than 500,000 in population, providing us control groups of observationally equivalent issuers who narrowly missed the direct lending cutoff. So this, combined with the timing of the announcement, is going to allow us to isolate the effects of one particular intervention against a backdrop of sort of many active policies during this period using a regression discontinuity design. And so we'll be looking at both the investor perceived value by separately analyzing yields across the ratings distribution, as well as the government perceived value for budget officers and CFOs charged with hiring decisions. And we call this the option value of emergency liquidity because take-up is not mandatory, of course, and in practice, it was quite low. So that's a puzzle that we return to at the end. So we've talked about a lot of this already, but we just wanted to mention the sort of key interventions that are indicated by three dashed lines throughout the talk. So everything prior to March 23rd is kind of the pre-period, and then after April 27th is the post-period. So the first was after a record sell-off of munis from mutual funds, the Fed expanded the MMLF to accept variable rate demand notes as pledgeable collateral to make loans to banking institutions. And that was what initially drove demand for munis back up from the brink. Then on April 9th, the MLF was announced as a special purpose vehicle with a $35 billion treasury backstop for a maximum of $500 billion in short-term muni note lending. And eligible issuers here included states, initially only cities greater than 1 million and counties greater than 2 million, and only bonds with less than two-year maturities, which were all priced at sort of a penalty rate, and that pricing was nonlinear by issuer rating. So not listed here, the MLF was also announced as part of a larger $2.3 trillion intervention, including the PPP and several corporate facility expansions. So focusing on the timing alone, as Blake mentioned, is a bit challenging. And so often we're sort of left with evaluating the totality of effects. And so finally, crucially for our empirical strategy, on April 27th, eligibility was greatly expanded to 250,000 for cities and 500,000 for counties and admitted up to three-year maturity notes to give states some maneuvering room as balanced budget requirements often preclude deficit borrowing across fiscal cycles. But this permitted sort of a window for potential constitutional amendments. Okay, so why were these particular population cutoffs chosen? Well, we have this nice quote in the paper by Kent Heitschu, which emphasizes that the largest issuers were initially targeted with an eye towards speed and execution. And so what we've done here is shown the initial population cutoffs, the right dashed lines, followed by the expanded cutoffs with the left dashed lines. And the first thing to notice is that while there were only a few issuers above the initial cutoffs shown in the top two panels, their bonds traded with far greater frequency above the initial cutoffs shown, their bonds traded with greater frequency indicated by those tall blue bars. And so this sort of belies the logic that one way to move the aggregate market is just to start with the top. So the second thing worth noting is that our design would not have been possible had the original cutoffs been retained. So the expansion sort of allows us to take advantage of richer data very close to the cutoff. And in this paper, we sort of show that the baseline characteristics around that second cutoff are balanced in very narrow windows close to the cutoff. And lastly, the eligibility populations used were sort of lagged by a year or two. So all of this sort of suggests that MLF optionality was as if randomly assigned very close to the cutoff. So we put together sort of many data sources. We start with a list of issuers that ever had active debt on Bloomberg. We then take all MSRB trades from January 2019 through the end of 2020 and merge the issuer names to Census Bureau localities to get both their populations that determine eligibility and their associated QCEW public sector employment numbers. We then also pulled on monthly bond ratings from S&P, Fitch, and Moody's, and map all of these to sort of these aggregate bucketed bins, A, AA, et cetera, calculating for each issuer a plurality issuer rating across bonds and ratings agencies by month. And finally, for Mergent, we have a number of bond characteristics, as well as any primary issuance that was never traded on the market. So after sample restrictions, this results in about 2.8 million trades and 94,000 trades from roughly 750 issuers in our smallest subsample, which is low-rated A and BBB city and county issuers post-MLF. So similar to the prior talk, we're going to show some plots of the raw data within an arbitrary 100,000 population bandwidth around the cutoff, which really highlights the underlying variation in the design and tells sort of most of the story. So these are just raw weekly means based on whether your January 2020 pre-COVID credit rating was high or low. MLF eligible cities and counties that are sort of within 100,000 above the cutoff are indicated in blue, while ineligible issuers less than 100,000 are in red, so think red distress. And so what first shines through among high-rated issuers is that on aggregate, the spike in yields obviously seems to have begun to decline right after the first announcement, but not really differentially based on your MLF access. But among low-rated issuers on the right, a strong wedge begins to develop exactly when the revised cutoffs are announced, while the placebo period prior to market turmoil remains sort of relatively balanced. So in fact, ineligible A and BBB yields mimic that elevated distress pattern in the larger BBB market, which we saw earlier, while those with MLF access look a bit more like safer bonds, exhibiting a fuller recovery with the MLF option. So briefly, I'm just going to glaze over this part. This is sort of the formal estimation of the graphs we just saw, the regression discontinuity, where bond yields, when they're the outcome, we're going to be tracking sort of trade N of bond B issued by issuer I in period T. One benefit to this formulation is that this alpha variable can be interpreted as the control group mean. So it represents sort of the mean control group yields or employment very close to the cutoff. And then for our heterogeneity results, our preferred specification has state and month fixed effects to absorb noise from balanced budget requirement stringency. And when the sample is constrained to 2020, these also absorb sort of state-specific tax exemption rules. Okay, so here is our preferred specification where each row reflects a separate regression. So the 72 basis point effect is the formal estimate associated with the trends we showed you earlier. And if you compare the size of this effect with the baseline mean, either 265 or 305, depending on what you benchmark to, you get about a 23 to 27% effect size as a share of baseline yields, which is sort of a really sizable effect, but only for low-rated issuers. And then reassuringly, in the placebo, we don't find any such effects prior to the policies being in place. And then not shown here, issuer and bond characteristics are sort of completely balanced in these samples. And so this is just to show you that we get the pretty RD version of the table, where the 72 basis point effect is just the jump in the intercept on the right. But for sake of time, I'll just move on here and just mention that these plots and these estimates are completely robust to sort of any bond characteristics you throw at it, geo revenue bond, different tax adjustment methods, inclusion of refis, right. So I'm going to show now some simple plots of cumulative new primary issuances since January 2020 by ratings, having you focus on the plot on the right, which shows earlier debt issuance among these MLF eligible issuers. So while there are only five of these sort of very low rated issuers in this very tight window close to the cutoff, the associated RD estimate is statistically significant and the sign is consistent with the secondary market yield effects. So we think there's sort of a channel here between secondary market functioning, which feeds back into primary issuance. So finally, we turn to asking whether budget officers and CFOs responded to the MLF by rehiring public sector employees. And for this, we use QCEW data, which provides monthly local government employment counts, but combined at the county level. So we can't separate city from county employees. So this poses a bit of a problem because some cities to the left of the county cutoff may be treated, while some counties to the left of the city cutoff may be treated. And further complicating things, there are some that are double treated. So there are really these three representative groups. And what we're going to do is just compare the A types and the C types on the right of the cutoff with those counties that never were treated either by a city or a county. And so this might sort of cause concerns for breaking the randomization in the RD. So our main results sort of look at the year-on-year differences in employment or percent changes in employment to kind of control for these unforeseen concerns. So this is sort of the main table of our employment effects, where each estimate is again from a separate regression. And the first thing to note is that the control group means below suggests we're analyzing fairly large counties with roughly 18,000 local city and county employees, which experienced a 1,700 employee year-on-year loss. These point estimates of 200 to 300 suggest that emergency liquidity induced greater recalls. However, this is only statistically significant when focusing on service-providing jobs, the lion's share of which sort of are coming from educational institutions. So on a drop of roughly 1,700 employees, eligible localities gained back 422 to 517 workers, which is an immense 25% roughly of the initial decline. That's only among service providing jobs. So interestingly, we can then chart out the year-on-year employment effects in any given month and get this plot, which reveals sort of a striking school year pattern. So April, May, and June workers were recalled despite persistent lockdowns during this time, again, driven largely by educational institutions. So combined with sort of additional results, which show that this pattern is most sustained in the long run for highly rated governments, we begin to hone in on a story in which governments were extremely sensitive to emergency liquidity, suggesting that they may have, in fact, been sort of overly cautious in their initial furloughing. However, this plot brings up sort of another concern, which is that we detect these differential RD effects in April prior to the MLF cutoff expansion, even though there were no such effects on yields. And so the main confounder here is that the CARES Aid CRF formula actually shares one cutoff with the MLF, allowing cities and states to access more direct aid if they exceed 500,000 in population. And so we do some extra tests taking advantage of the different amount of aid and lending and find suggestive evidence that most of these employment effects are in fact being driven by CARES aid. So that is, grant funding is impacting hiring while the lending backstop is really affecting yields. So the last result I want to leave you with is a mechanism test. We showed that investors responded to MLF access, but only if lower rated. And this begs the question, you know, was the availability of the MLF perceived by investors as sharing credit risk? So on the left, we show that in fact, issuers that narrowly missed the cutoff were also more likely to have their credit downgraded over time. Now on the right, we have some work in progress in which we decompose yields into sort of their default risk and liquidity components and show that rising credit risk played a significant role in the run-up to the peak crisis period for all issuers, but especially for lower rated sort of cities and counties. Okay, so to wrap up, we find that the MLF improved overall market functioning and that MLF eligible credit risk sharing seems to play an important role, explaining at least part of the long-term distress pattern in the BBB market. We provide evidence that MLF eligible issuers were disproportionately likely to issue new debt and recall state and local employees, but suggestive evidence shows that this rehiring was most likely due to CARES aid rather than the MLF. And while the results generally imply that the muni market and real economy outcomes would have been worse absent the intervention, one final puzzle that needs to be probed in future work is whether the low MLF take-up rate relates to the facility's pricing. So if you just quickly look at this last plot, this is the...
We're already about 4 minutes over. I want to make sure that we...
I'll just stop here then. thank you so much, and I'll leave you with that, and looking forward to the discussion and questions.
Excellent. Hopefully there'll be in the Q&A a question about that. But I want to turn it over now to Melissa Moy from the United States Department of the Treasury to discuss this paper. So Melissa, please go ahead.
Sure. And I'm going to try to share my screen as well. What I'm attempting to share is actually on the website, and it's simply a summary that distills the primary results of the paper. And actually, the comments are those of the authors, not my own. I do plan to.
We don't see it yet. I don't think it's been shared yet.
Let's try that.
That's excellent. That works.
Great. Thanks, Dan. So I plan to pose just a few questions and a few areas to consider expanding the research. And I hope to leave a few extra minutes for Ben as well, because he, you know, a huge amount has gone into this work. And there is more to share from him. And I would very much like to thank Ben and Andy and Orr for taking on this research. Finally, I don't speak for Treasury, and the views that are expressed here are my own. So the paper clearly delineates the primary aims of the MLF, which is to help state and local governments manage cash flow pressures, which are brought on by COVID, and also to restore the muni bond market to normal functioning. It was not designed to plug longer-term budget gaps. And of course, since then, those issues have been targeted by significant fiscal programs. As Ben stated, a critical element of the muni market disruption in March of 2020 and a real motivator of the MMLF collateral expansion to VRDNs was the VRDN rate spike during March 2020. And I have suggested to Ben that they may add some more just contextual information on the muni swap rate trends at that time. In terms of the MMLF and the MLF, the previous authors actually discussed a good amount the difficulty of parsing out the effects cumulatively. But I do think some additional consideration of what kind of methodology could be used to parse out those effects over time, that deserves additional thought, because there really are questions that remain. To what extent did the MLF rely on the presence of the expanded MMLF? Was there a combined or a layered effect? How effective would the MLF have been without the MMLF? And how important was the timing of the MMLF expansion, which preceded the MLF announcement by over 2 weeks? So as stated in the testimony to Congress, the MLF eligibility size cutoff was in fact driven by concern about delivering the facility quickly and efficiently for issuers and for the market. I think in general, it'd be helpful if the research could shed more light on the responsiveness of the primary and the secondary markets to these various constraints on eligibility, different size cutoffs, different eligibility or eligibility of different types of government issuers. I mean, a thought question, is it reasonable to expect that a program with a similar population size cutoff would be effective in the future? So the paper correctly raises the question of how the MLF impact was transmitted from short-term to long-term yields, from the short-term to long-term bonds. The primary mechanism that's posited is that short-term borrowing is used to pay long-term debt service. And it would be great to know more about how they might test this for this hypothesis, test investor response to issuers subject to strict use of funds and low spending fungibility versus issuers with a more permissive regime, for example. With the MLF, the Fed chose primary market support as its main venue for a policy lever in the municipal market. What does your research say about when this focus on the primary market would be effective. In other words, other situations without also purchasing on the secondary market. And finally, to what extent was the $500 billion capacity of the facility, it was huge, a substantial factor in spurring confidence and improving investor demand for municipal bonds? For instance, would a $200 billion facility have been enough? So as you can see, my comments really focus on remaining policy questions, most of which really can't be addressed by the regression discontinuity approach based on MLF's issuer size cutoff. So it's really sort of thinking beyond, in some sense, the paper. I really want to thank the research team for supplying rigorous formal methods to the available market data and congratulate you on a very useful paper. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Ben, do you want to take, there's some echo there. Can you guys hear me okay? Ben, do you want to take a moment? And, you know, Melissa had a bunch of great questions. Do you want to respond?
Yeah, so thanks so much, Melissa, for the great comments. And apologies for going over. There was a lot to pack in here. I think you hit the main question on the head, which also Blake and Weixin were trying to address, which is sort of the totality question. So we've got this great strategy for looking at sort of local mechanisms with this regression discontinuity, but that doesn't tell you anything about the aggregate effects or the sort of counterfactual of what would have happened absent either one of the interventions, or were there another, either would it be a different cutoff in population or a size of, let's call it the backstop bazooka, whether that would have been, larger or smaller would have been more appropriate. Again, these are all, I should say again, our own views and not the views of the system, but there was some discussion early on about the sizing of the backstop. And I think the predominant message was to send a signal that there would be a huge package that would address many elements of the market. And because these assets are all interrelated, I think that was sort of the strategy, even though the expected take up, especially in a short-term market, would never kind of hit that $500 billion cap. So I think that we're doing some extra work now to sort of try to decompose these aggregate effects, similar to what Blake and Weixin had done, but focusing more not on pre-refunded bonds. But I think that's definitely sort of the next area of research for us. I did have one thing that I didn't get to say. Well, I sort of rushed it through, but I think Dan might ask it to me, which is in terms of lessons learned, one area is sort of regarding the pricing of the facility and especially the penalty pricing. So were the pricing to sort of have been more steeper for lower rated issuers, or even if the whole level of the penalty was kind of down a level, would that have induced higher take-up of the program and not disproportionate take-up at the low end of the market? I think that's sort of a pending question that we also hope to address in future work.
I want to acknowledge now the presence of the two co-authors of this work. So in addition to Ben Hyman, we have Ora Shekhar and we have Andy Hogwart. Andy, did I get that name right?
Close enough.
Howitt. Okay. So Andy Howitt, and I think, do either of you want to jump in now and share your thoughts as a co-author of this paper?
Maybe I'll just also thank Melissa for the comments. I'm looking forward to any other questions that come from the floor. I think you did, Melissa, put your finger on some of the key policy questions. I mean, of course, a major purpose of writing the paper was to inform future policymakers about the particular elements of the MLF and its interaction with other policy interventions and how they can learn from that for future interventions when needed. So, I think Melissa is exactly the right discussion for this paper because she's got exactly that perspective, and so we appreciate her thoughts.
And Orr, do you?
Yeah, so again, Melissa, thank you very much. So just to the point about the differential effect of the credit. So as Ben mentioned, we are working on the decomposition, and there we actually, unlike the Bean Marsh paper, where they are looking at the pre-funding subsample that might be smaller, we are looking at a at the broader sample where we are measuring liquidity directly, and then the residual we treat it as default, controlling for all the bond characteristics. So there we also find consistent result with the regression discontinuity approach. So that's kind of encouraging in that respect.
So I actually have a question as the moderator. You know, I don't know if this is allowed, but I've got a question, and I hope this isn't too naive of a question, but what are the legal and practical barriers, or what would have been the legal and practical barriers to using the states as conduits, just sort of instead of saying we're going to lend directly to cities and counties, just creating the expectation that you know, we will create the facility for states, and then the states will, you know, in the spirit of federalism, do their thing with the municipalities and localities.
Yeah, so we didn't really get into this, but state downstreaming was permitted in this program. So there was sort of a large cap offered to states, but the degree to which states can pass through, I think is what you're focusing on, is limited by the state legislative approval. Beyond sort of that, I don't know if Andy has a further color to add to that. But that's sort of, I think the view was that this would sort of require a piecemeal coordination across many agents.
Yeah, and I'll just add, I mean, one of the lessons learned here may be that these decisions ultimately become quite political. There was quite a lot of discussion early on when the Fed actually discussed downstreaming, and, you know, it's explicitly in the term sheet. And I think the response that we received from the public to some degree was, well, in some states that might be much more feasible for certain governments than other governments. And there's all kinds of political, in addition to legal and constitutional constraints on the willingness or ability of state governments to downstream. So I think that was part of the motivation for the Fed's and the Treasury's joint decision to expand the eligibility of the facility. I should mention these are my views and not those of the Federal Reserve System, in case I had forgotten to mention that.
What, or do you wanna?
Yeah, I will just add one more thing into that. Like in normal times also, there is heterogeneity across rates in out there handling Chapter 9, as observed by Gao and others in their paper. So that's just an extreme case of that kind of difference across state.
To what extent does your identification strategy depend on the expansion having been a surprise to the market?
So I think, yeah, the timing does matter. We saw that the sort of yields budged exactly on the starting on the week of the day where the announcement was made. I think we've done a lot of good work to show that the cutoffs chosen, at least in the cross section, were sort of heuristically chosen, i.e. orthogonal to the underlying characteristics. But certainly the timing, what I think the timing does for us, it's not so much that it was unexpected. It may have been expected and a broader expansion of some kind might have been expected, but the specifics of the population cutoffs is what might have come as a surprise, or at least as something that the market had to react to. And that's what we're able to observe.
Do you have we have a minute left. Do you have any last words that you want to share with the audience? Any of the authors or Melissa is the discussant?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank all of you again for organizing and thank Melissa, who was very kind and flexible with us as we sort of sent some last minute revisions as well. So thank you all for the great comments, and we look forward to incorporating them in the next draft.
Great. Thanks to all of you. And thanks to the audience who's involved in this as well. We are now going to take a 10-minute break. So we're going to break for 10 minutes. The session will stay open and live. I'm going to turn off my microphone and camera. And then when we reconvene, we'll have a paper at 12:55. This is the paper by the team of researchers at the Federal Reserve Board this time in Cornell that Alex Zhao is going to present. So we'll reconvene in about 10 minutes. All right. We are back. It's 12:55, and we are back for the second set of two papers at the first day of the Municipal Finance Conference. Before we dive into the papers, I want to just make a couple of announcements. The first is that if you're interested in participating in the Q&A part of this, you can go to the Slido website, that's sli.do, and use the code MUNIFINANCE, so that's all one word, and submit your questions or comments in that way. The second thing that I want to highlight is an opportunity that will occur Wednesday. So on Wednesday, we're having two open invitation, concurrent breakout sessions. This is Wednesday at 1:30 p.m. East Coast time. So it'll be 10:30 p.m. on the West Coast. I'll be moderating a session where we're invited to discuss recent developments in municipal bond structure, advanced refunding, you know, taxable versus tax-exempt bonds, all of those parts of the market. Louise Shaner of the Brookings Institution will be moderating an informal group discussion talking about dynamics in state and local finances. Details on these open invitation sessions are available in an email that went out from David Wessel this morning. So without any further ado, I'm going to turn it over now to Alex Zhao from the Federal Reserve Board, who has 15 minutes to discuss this paper co-authored with Maureen O'Hara and Yi Li. And then the discussant is going to be Mayar Kargar from the University of Illinois. So thanks for being here again, and take it away, Alex.
Thank you, Dan. I want to thank the conference organizers for including our paper into the program. As Dan just introduced, the paper is joined with Yi Li, my colleague at the Federal Reserve Board, and Maureen O'Hara at Cornell. Since I work at the board, the usual disclaimer applies. Both the paper and my discussion today are our own views, not necessarily those of the Fed. So let me start with a very quick introduction to the study. We know that fixed income mutual funds do a lot of liquidity transformation. They offer liquidity to their investors and allow them to redeem their shares on a daily basis. But at the same time, you know, most of the fixed income assets that they hold are very illiquid, and they can take weeks or even longer to liquidate. A number of studies have shown that, you know, when funds face a negative shocks to the assets that they hold, this liquidity transformation could generate a first mover advantage among the investors and lead to amplified redemptions. You know, several recent papers have also shown that these amplified redemptions could affect the underlying asset markets. For example, fund outflows have been shown to lead fire sales and affect price and volatility in the corporate bond market. Now, what we don't know much about is sort of the role played by dealers in transmitting the fragility risks posed by mutual funds. We know that the dealers are very important in the function of most fixed income markets. And you know, this increased the demand for liquidity from these mutual funds could potentially threaten the market stability if the dealers are not there to provide liquidity. So what we're going to do is that we're going to use the COVID-19 crisis to analyze the volatility risks that mutual funds introduce to the muni market. And as I'll show very shortly, you know, the key feature of our analysis is that we're going to incorporate the role of muni dealers in transmitting the mutual fund volatility risks. And we're going to ask the following questions. The first question we're going to look at is that how does trading in munis relate to mutual fund ownership during the height of the crisis? And secondly, how do dealers behave when they face large selling pressures? And perhaps more importantly, you know, how do their behavior change for these bonds with larger potential mutual fund fire sale post crisis, and in the end, we are going to also explore the potential impact of mutual fund volatility risks on liquidity and pricing of munis. So, you know, there are a number of reasons for us to use the muni market to study mutual fund volatility risks. The market although it is still dominated by retail investors, mutual funds have grown to be the largest institutional investors, and they together hold about 20% of munis. The market is a large market that is highly illiquid, and it is highly segregated because of the state tax benefits, and you know the market heavily rely on dealers for intermediation. Unlike in the corporate bond market, you know, dealers in the muni market face few means to hedge price movements, partly because CDS market for most of the municipalities do not exist. And lastly, holding concentrations of munis by mutual funds are higher than that of corporate bonds. So a key sort of question for our analysis is that how do we disentangle the effects of mutual fund volatility risks from the general pandemic result effects? As I will show you, only about 30% of municipal bonds are held at all by mutual funds, with the rest predominantly held by retail investors. And this split sort of gives us a nice control group that captures the general pandemic effects. And you will see that although the behavior of the bonds held by mutual funds, although they are very similar to those not held by mutual funds before the crisis, they sort of diverge both during and post the crisis. Now, more importantly, we're going to control for this time varying effects of various bond characteristics. And in our strictest specification, we are going to include a issuer date fix effect. And this issuer date fix effect essentially allows us to sort of compare similar bonds from the same issuer and traded on the same day, but differ in terms of their mutual fund ownership. So as the background, I'm going to go very quick on this, since the two previous papers have sort of talked about this timeline of this municipal bond liquidity crisis during the COVID-19 pandemic. Between early to mid-March, the muni market came under stress, with the yield spread shooting from 1% to about 6%. And the mutual funds saw large outflows between these 2 weeks, from March the 9th to March the 23rd, they lost about 16% of their assets. And we know that the strain, this market conditions led the Federal Reserve to intervene with a series of facilities, including the municipal liquidity facility, the primary dealer credit facility, money market fund, liquidity facility, and the CP funding facility. And shortly after these interventions, the muni market conditions started to improve. Mutual fund outflow stopped and yield spread dropped substantially. So I'm going to show you three slides that is sort of providing a preview of our main results and sort of tell the whole story. So the first slide shows that the mutual fund redemptions destabilized the muni market during the COVID-19 crisis. The figure plots the trading volume of muni bonds separately for bonds held by mutual funds in red and the bonds that are not held by mutual funds. And as you can see, during the crisis time, which is sort of defined between these two drop lines, trading volumes increased six times, almost entirely driven by the trading of bonds held by mutual funds. Okay, now this slide shows that muni dealers play a key role in transmitting the fire sale risk of mutual funds. So the figure plots the total cumulative dealer inventory of munis, again, separately for bonds held by mutual funds in red and those not held by mutual funds in black. And as you can see, dealers are sort of performing their normal market-making activities during the 2 weeks leading to the crisis, but they stopped taking and they actually started selling bonds held by mutual funds at the height of the crisis. Now, what is interesting here, you see that the pattern, although they are sort of very similar, before the crisis, they started to diverge after the crisis. The dealers continue to cut down their inventories in the bonds held by mutual funds. And the last slide shows that mutual fund volatility risks introduced what we sort of call a fire sale premium incorporated in muni pricing in the post-crisis period. So this figure plots the tax-adjusted yield spread of munis, separately for bonds held by mutual funds and other bonds. And as you can see here, you know, before the crisis started, you know, they sort of moved together. But after the crisis, about 30 basis point wedge sort of persisted between the yield spreads of bonds held by mutual funds and that, you know, and those that are not. Now, obviously, you know, these figures are subject to alternative explanations. So in the rest of my talk, I will show a number of results from our regression analysis, where we hope to control for other potential confounding effects. And hopefully these results can help us you know, gain a better understanding of the potential volatility risks posed by mutual funds and the amplification of such volatility risks by the dealers. So I'm gonna go very quickly on the data we use. The sample you see in the paper starts from the end of 2019 to July 17, 2020. For municipal bonds, we collect the transaction level data on secondary market trading from MSRB, and the bond characteristic information is obtained from Mergent Municipal Bond Securities Database. For municipal mutual funds, we collect the security level holdings information, the quarterly you know, security level holding information from Thomson Reuters EMAX database, and we're able to do that for about 900 bonds. Also, for a subsample, for some sample analysis, we also collect the AUMs and daily investor flow for about 400 funds, and we merge these two data sets together using the fund names. So the first regression analysis we conducted is focused on the crisis period. And the question we want to ask is, you know, whether mutual fund ownership rather than other factors that drives the surge in muni trading during the crisis. The sample covers about four weeks from February 24th to March 20th. So the first 2 weeks, we call it a pre-crisis period. And then from March the 9th to March the 20th, we call it a crisis period. Now the sample is constructed at the bond and date level, which is sort of represented by INT. So it's a sort of a standard difference in difference regression. We regress the trading activity in bond I on day T on a dummy that is equal to one if the bond is held by mutual funds, a crisis dummy for the last 2 weeks of this sample period. And more importantly, the interaction with the crisis dummy and this held by mutual fund dummy. So essentially we wanted to see whether trading activities experienced any differential increase in the bonds held by mutual funds during these 2 weeks of the crisis period. We include a host of bond characteristics such as, you know, credit rating, coupon rate, age, time to maturity, amount of outstanding as sort of the basic bond characteristics. And in addition, we also include the fixed effects for bond type, for example, whether this is in the geo bonds or revenue bonds. We include a dummy for a dummy variable for bond sectors. And then we also include a dummy for the state of the municipality. The result in this column, the first column of this table shows the results from estimating our regression. And as you can see, compared to other bonds, those held by mutual funds experienced an additional 29% increase in trading activities during the crisis period. We also estimate a sort of a continuous version of the mutual fund ownership. So instead of a dummy to tell us whether the bond is held by mutual funds or not, we used a MF share variable, which is the percentage of a muni's outstanding amount that is held by mutual funds. And as you can see, the results continue to hold. And then we progressively include more fixed effects. For example, we control for issue fixed effect, and then also the date fixed effect, the results continue to hold. In the strictest specification, as I mentioned earlier, we control the bond characteristics, the interaction of the bond characteristics and the crisis dummy. And more importantly, we also have the issuer date fixed effect. So the results basically suggest that, when you compare similar bonds by the same issuer on the same day, those with more mutual fund ownership experienced a larger increase in trading activities during the crisis. So one question obviously is that how dealers respond to, the question we wanted to ask here is that how did dealers respond to mutual fund sell-offs? And again, what we do is that we use the same four-week sample period, and then we re-estimate the empirical model, but now by replacing a total trading activity in a particular bond with this dealer net purchase. So the dealer net purchase is the dealer's aggregated purchase minus their aggregate sales in bond I on day T. And then we rest on, you know, held by mutual fund dummy, crisis dummy, and the interaction of the two with the same model specification. The results is presented in this table. As you can see from the first column, dealers sell more bonds with mutual fund holders during the crisis, with the coefficient of the interaction become negative and highly significant. And again, using a continuous version to capture the mutual fund ownership and, you know, progressively folding other fixed effects does not change our result. So one particular thing we wanted to sort of highlight here is that the materialization of the mutual fund volatility risks during the crisis seems to have some long-term impact on the muni market. As you can see here, you know, shortly after the Fed interventions, redemptions from muni funds sort of stopped, and fund flows largely normalized in April. And as you can see here, in May, muni funds start to attract consecutive inflows. So to sort of to further understand this post-crisis dealer liquidity provisions, we are going to ask another sort of difference in difference regression. So the empirical question is that whether dealers reduce their inventories in bonds bearing potential mutual fund volatility risks. So we are going to regress dealers' cumulative inventories in bond I on day T on a dummy for the post-crisis period, a dummy for held by mutual funds, and the interaction of the two. And again, the rest of the specification is very similar to the previous models that we estimate. Now, the difference here, one key difference here is that we're going to use a much longer sample period. So instead of just focusing on the 2 weeks before and after the start of the crisis, now we are going to look at the whole sample period. So the sample starts on January the 3rd and to January the 17th, but we're going to exclude March and April. So one key difference between the paper and, you know, the other papers that you saw earlier is that we are not evaluating the impact of the Fed facilities on the muni market. We are sort of more focused on the aftermath of this muni market liquidity crisis. So the pre-crisis is January and February, with May, June, and part of the July as the post-crisis period. And it, as you can see here, dealers reduce their inventories more in bonds bearing higher mutual fund volatility risks. And the change in dealers' behavior seems to be sort of reflected in the market liquidity conditions. We use, you know, the bid-ask spread of the bond as the dependent variable and find that post-crisis liquidity seems to deteriorate more in bonds held by mutual funds. This liquidity, the deterioration seems to be more severe among those most frequently traded bonds.
Alex, then we want to step in as moderator just to signal the time, to be aware of the time. We're 3 minutes over.
Okay, thank you. One more minute, I'll finish. So we also look at the tax-adjusted bond yield spreads to understand the pricing of the mutual fund volatility risks. So again, we regress the bond yield spreads on this sort of using the this difference in difference regression, and the model basically shows that in the post-crisis period, all muni bonds have high yield spreads with a coefficient for the post-crisis to be positive, but yield spreads for bonds held by mutual funds increased by additional 34 basis points, and the results sort of are robust to different measures and specifications. And the last question we show is, you know, we explore is that if the pricing effects are indeed driven by the fear for potential mutual fund runs, then we should expect such pricing effects to be stronger for bonds held by mutual funds who are more susceptible to runs. So indeed, what we did is that we cut the sample of the bonds into two subsamples based on their mutual fund holders' volatility measures, depending on their sort of, you know, exposure to the COVID pandemic, the average maturity of their portfolio or the liquidity of the portfolio. And we do find that the pricing effect seems to be substantially stronger in the subsample of the bonds where, you know, whose mutual fund owner seems to be subject to more run risks. So let me just conclude, you know, invest investors' redemption from mutual funds seems to destabilize the muni market during the COVID-19 crisis. We show that the dealers play a key role in transmitting the financial risk of mutual funds, and the fragility risks posed by mutual funds seems to have lasting effects on the muni market, and the pricing effects are stronger when a bond's holding funds are more susceptible to potential investor runs. Thank you. Sorry for taking more time.
Great. I want to turn it over now to Mayar Kagar from the University of Illinois. So take it away.
If we can, Alex, unshare. So, perfect. All right. Thank you so much for asking me to discuss this interesting paper. So I really enjoyed reading the paper. So I'm just going to quickly summarize what Alex just showed us. So basically, the idea is that mutual fund redemption destabilized the muni market in March 2020. And given the fact that there's this inherent mutual fund liquidity mismatch for bond funds mainly, that leads to runs. It's already established in the empirical theoretical literature. Sorry. And basically, what Alex showed us very convincingly that munis held by mutual funds basically had around 30% higher trading volume relative to the bonds that were not held by mutual funds. And among the ones that were held by mutual funds, we see higher yield spreads for bonds with higher outflows and also higher volume for munis held by the funds with larger redemptions. And results, as I said, are very robust. They do a very careful empirical analysis. There's definitely no issues there. And then importantly, the dealers, as Alex mentioned, have a pretty important role in transmitting us the shock from mutual fund redemptions. So importantly, before, like 2 weeks before we see these outflows on March 9th, we see that dealers actually started accumulating more munis held by mutual funds than other bonds. And authors speculate that this could be probably due to the fact that bonds want to accumulate cash reserves in anticipation of outflows. During the crisis, we see this actually reversing. We see that dealers ended up being net sellers of the munis held by mutual funds and then sell around $20,000 more per bond day for munis that held by mutual funds. And importantly, what's like really kind of interesting and kind of puzzling to me is that after the market kind of stabilized in May to July, we see that dealers actually continued to shed inventories of these bonds that are held by mutual funds and sold on average around $267,000 more of these bonds that are held by mutual funds. This fragility risk post-crisis is priced. So we see around 34 or 33 basis point yield premium for munis that are held by mutual funds post-crisis. And the premium in comparison was only 6 basis points pre-crisis. And the interesting thing is that there's no difference in yields during the crisis. And this is actually unlike what happened in the corporate bond market that I'm going to basically talk a lot about that during my discussion. So the mechanism that they discuss is that they're very careful. They look at measures that are suggested in a different paper, and they relate it to potential run risk. And also they show that it's not going to be selection. It's not bond type. It's not reaching for yield by muni mutual funds. So they make it very convincing that it's the run risk. So I want to quickly show you the facts for the muni and corporate bond markets, and kind of we see how these two markets contrast. Again, these two markets both are over-the-counter market. Dealers have a very large role in both of these markets. Now I'm going to show you like what the difference is in these two markets during this crisis. So first, look at yield spread. So all the plots on the left are going to be from the corporate bond market, and all the plots on the right would be from the muni market, mainly from the paper that Alex just presented. So we see that, I mean, yield spreads on average, like both kind of went up dramatically during the crisis for both markets and then went down due to the interventions of the Fed and different interventions, obviously, in these two different markets. Transaction costs, I mean, the left one is from my paper with my co-author. So kind of almost similar patterns. We see transaction costs went up during the crisis and then went down after the intervention. The right one is from the paper that Ben just presented. How about mutual fund flows? I mean, we see very similar patterns again. during the outflows. The left is from a paper by Falotto, Goldstein, and Hortoksu from forthcoming in the Journal of Monetary Economics. We see, again, large outflows during the height of the crisis, very similar pattern that we saw in what Alex just showed us. But the very different plots are in the dealer inventories. They are dramatically different in the between the corporate bond market and the muni market. So the left one is from, again, my paper with my co-authors about the corporate bond market. We see dramatically different behavior post-crisis. So during the crisis, dealers actually shed a lot of inventory during like height of the crisis. Again, dealers became net sellers, kind of similar pattern that we saw around here in the muni market. But to contrast this with the post-crisis, where dealers continue to sell, whereas in the corporate bond market, dealers continue to actually dramatically increase their inventories. So again, as I mentioned, the dealers are very different, behave very differently in these two markets. Author's explanation was this is because there was not there was not a secondary market facility for munis, unlike corporate bond market. I mean, Fed directly and indirectly intervened in both of these markets. So the primary dealer credit facility was the indirect way of one of the indirect ways of Fed interventions. They allowed primary dealers to borrow against munis and corporate bonds, and then Fed directly intervened through the corporate credit facilities in March 23rd, both in the primary and secondary market, whereas in the MLF, the only intervention was in the primary market. Actually, interestingly, one of the architects of the MLF had an interview with one of the Bloomberg correspondents on April 2020, and then this question was brought up: why didn't you do a secondary market intervention? And the gentleman, Kent Hetshow, basically mentioned we considered that, and the Fed would have actually deployed a secondary market facility if the MMLF and MLF hadn't been sufficient. So they considered this, but turned out not being required. So I'm not going to go through MLF. It's been discussed in the previous paper in detail. Again, the immediate purpose of the MLF was to enhance liquidity to the primary short-term municipal securities. So interestingly, also, Alex and co-authors don't find any impact of time to maturity in the kind of impact on the corporate and the muni market. So I'm going to go talk about my comments. My first comments is we don't see any fire sale premium during the crisis. So this is, like, again, plot from their paper. We see the fire sale premium only shows up post-crisis. You see these two graphs start to diverge after the muni market comes to normality. So it's kind of like a little bit puzzling to me, given the fact that, so as I mentioned, the fire sale risk premium for muni appears post-crisis, and the redemption largely reversed actually in April 2020. So arguably, run risk should be higher during the crisis when everyone is selling. And why don't we see run risk price only post-crisis? It's puzzling to me. I don't have a good answer for this. And I don't know, maybe run risk doesn't seem like to be the whole story. So I don't know. My second comment is about which dealers actually reduce inventory in muni. So this is the plot on the left-hand side that I looked at from the data through the New York Fed. This is the primary dealer statistics data from New York Fed, the weekly data. So I went and looked at the net positions of the primary dealers on the left-hand side and right-hand side in the same plot that I showed you earlier. We see that actually primary dealers ended up like stabilizing their inventories post-crisis. Whereas, as you see, it's a very different picture from what Alex shows us from the MSRB. So the question that I have is, again, this is, again, contrasting it again with respect to the corporate bond market. This is, again, from a paper with Maureen and Alex that they have in the JFE. It looks like for the corporate bond market, again, primary dealers and non-primary dealers behave very, very similarly. Both of them kind of post-crisis start increasing inventories. So this is a little bit, again, puzzling what's going on in the muni market that we do not see in the corporate bond market. So my question is, like, okay, so we see that these muni inventories for primary deals actually stabilize, but this basically tells me that the non-primary dealers must have sold post-crisis, right? So otherwise, the only way I can make sense of what Alex shows us is that non-primary dealers must be the net sellers. This is, again, in contrast to what we observe in the corporate bond market. So maybe I'm speculating here. Is there a difference between the dealer networks and the muni market versus the corporate bond market? There's this like famous paper by Lee and Sherhoff in the Journal of Finance, which basically shows you that the dealer network in the muni market has a core periphery structure, and the core is around 10 to 30 dealers, and the periphery has around 2,000 dealers. And the question that I have is, are these primary dealers in the periphery, so not that important, so they don't have, basically on an aggregate, doesn't have that much of an impact on the inventory of the muni market? But again, interestingly, also the corporate bond market also has a core periphery network, as a nice paper in the Journal of Financial Economics by DiMaggio, Kermani, and Song shows that actually that market also has a core periphery structure. So again, I'm not sure what's going on here. Again, this is like a question that I don't have a good answer for. And finally, so there's this so-called pecking order of liquidity happened in the corporate bond market. There's again a paper by Mao, Zhao, and Zeng that show that actually, consistent with the dash for cash, corporate bonds, actually mutual funds sold their most liquid assets first, and then bonds with higher liquidation rank in the mutual funds had higher drops in price, higher risk premium. And a higher liquidation rank means that a more liquid bond within a mutual fund family. So the question that I have, do we see the same pecking order of liquidity for muni, because we see this dash for cash and basically pervasive in very different markets. So I'm just like curious to see if we see that in the muni market as well. So this is kind of the plot of from their paper. We see that the bonds that are in the first quartile of liquidity, the most liquid one, has a higher credit risk during the crisis. So it's interesting to see that. And again, I'm out of time. Let me summarize. Again, I really enjoyed reading the paper. This is a very nice, a careful empirical work. Again, they provide evidence that mutual fund redemption adversely impacts the municipal bond market, and dealers play an important role in propagating this rand risk. Again, as I mentioned, dealers behave very differently in the corporate bond market relative to the muni market. So I want to try to understand why, and then why the fire sale premium wasn't present during the crisis. Is there a difference between primary dealers and non-primary dealers? And is there any pecking order in terms of liquidation for munis? And thank you so much for the opportunity to discuss.
Great. Can you guys hear me okay? Give me a thumbs up if y'all can hear. Excellent. Alex, do you want to take a minute? We have about a minute to respond to that. We've got to start the next paper at 1:30, but I think you have a minute to respond.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mahir, for a very useful, very helpful discussion. Some of the comments you raised, we are actually looking into that right now. So let me just get to your comment 3 first. This pecking order of liquidation. So we are getting the cash holdings of these mutual funds. And, since our focus is really not on understanding mutual funds' behavior when facing redemptions, our focus is on understanding their impact on the underlying market. So, tests we're doing include how does the impact of different mutual fund ownership differ depending on their cash holdings? Presumably, those if you're held by mutual funds with more cash holdings, then the impact on the underlying would be much smaller. So that's what we're doing. And now going back to the first question, why there's not much difference between these two type of the bonds during the crisis, we are actually also kind of puzzled by that. Now, one thing I could imagine is that these are the sort of the aggregate plots. So there's a lot of sort of selection bias in terms of what bonds are traded in the crisis versus the others. And when we control for this bond fixed effect in some of the regression analysis, we do see that there's some difference between these two types of bonds during the crisis. And another possible reason that there might be some sort of spillover effects across different type of the bonds during the crisis. And lastly, what's the difference between primary dealers versus non-primary dealers? Unfortunately, our data do not have dealer identity so far, so we cannot tell the difference. But the reason that you see So the reason why you observe different patterns between the primary dealer positions versus all plots is that, you know, the plots you see are based on the FIR 2004 data, which is sort of the dealers aggregate the inventory. Now, in this paper, we only target at their secondary market trading. So it does not include their inventories from their from the new issues. And that could potentially explain the difference between these two type of these two figures. But again, thank you very much for your discussion.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Great paper, great discussion. We're right on time for the final paper that we have today. So this is work. The presenter is going to be Ivan Ivanov of the Federal Reserve Board in DC. This is the work of a team of authors at the Fed and at the University of Cologne. So he'll present. He'll have 15 minutes to present, and then we're going to have a discussant. So Emily Swenson-Brock of the GFOA will be the discussant. And so I see Ivan there. Take it away.
Let me share my screen. Thank you, Dan. Let's see. Okay, here. All right. Thank you very much for inviting us. This is joint work with Tom and Nathan. And before I go any further, I should say the views expressed here are our own and not the ones of the Fed. Okay, so what is the main motivation for this study? So this figure here on the left comes from my other paper with Tom, where we show that state and local governments have significantly increased their reliance on bank loans and other types of private debt. This rise has been really like steep. You can see that since 2009 or 10, the bank loans, like as a source of funding for state and local entities, has more than quadrupled over that time frame. And you can see a similar trend for muni bonds held by banks that to some extent are also private debt. Now, like, why do we care about this trend? Well, it's because adding such claims to like muni debt structure is likely to affect muni bond holders. So again, in our other paper with Tom, we showed that bank loans have significantly shorter maturities than bonds of the same entity. And they're very likely to be secured by revenue streams that are specific, that are highly like specific. So it may be the case that in large number of these cases, the muni private debt could be more senior than the bonds of the same entity. So we need to worry about it. We need to be able as a market to like observe these. So what I want to highlight here is that there were no disclosure requirements for such type of claims until early 19. And the SEC has aimed to like remedy such concerns by issuing a rule in 2018 that became effective in early 19. So what we do in this paper in a nutshell, we study whether this regulation has been effective over the past several years. So let me just briefly highlight what we find in this paper, and then I'm going to like take a deeper dive. So we showed that roughly half of the muni market at this point is required to report private debt. Whenever filings occur about such obligations, their information content varies widely, as I'll show you in a little bit. But on average, the market views these as being informative. So in the second part of the paper, we use confidential data from the Federal Reserve and showed that about 20 to 46% of likely reportable bank loan events, only 20 to 46% of likely reportable bank loan events get indeed reported on the MSRB website. So you see a vast under reporting And so overall, what we conclude in the paper is that such type of debt remains a significant source of risk for muni bondholders. All right, so for the background, so more specifically, in this rule, we like in this paper, we studied the amendments of rule SEC rule 15C212, which was finalized in August of 2018 and implemented in February 27, 2019. So in a nutshell, so these two quotes show you the two main areas where the rule like requires additional disclosure. So in the first quote, it basically says that like agreements to like such debt have to be reported now by issuers. And the second quote shows you that any material modification of terms of such financial obligations that are related to financial weakness also have to be reported. Now, what's really unclear here is the extent to which the rule like is going to pick up the economic like reality in this market. And so like, why is that the case? Because if you go back to the first quote, you can see that there's some ambiguity as to whether the rule applies to like originations of loans or private debt renegotiations, or whether it applies to both. Because agreement here could mean both. And then, like, second, it's very important to know that in this market, in the muni bank loan market, the renegotiation of private debt occurs very often, and it does change the term of the loans by a large amount. Okay, so more on this a little later. So who is under this rule? Like, so I said, like, at this point, you have half and half of the market. So the bar for whether you're subject to this rule is pretty low. So issuers that issue bonds with amount that at least that exceeds at least $1 million are subject to the rule. So this issuance has to happen since the implementation date of the rule. Like that's another key part. So since February 27th of 19. The rule exempts issues that are sold to a small number of sophisticated investors in large denominations or short-term bonds that are also sold in large denominations. Now, it's very important to emphasize here that the SEC as an agency of the federal government doesn't have authority over the state and local governments. So the SEC has authority over the underwriters that underwrites the bonds in the space. So basically, the underwriter here has this responsibility to enter into a continuing disclosure agreement with the issuer, and under which issuers have to report all agreements that are material. So, okay, so basically, I'm going to now get into the data. Our main data set comes from this cool new data from MSRB, this MSRB municipal disclosure feed. Our data on bank loans comes from the Federal Reserve. Like, we have very rich data at the loan level. These are loans extended by the largest banks in the states. These loans pretty much account for 3/4 of the market, of the muni bank loan market. You like observe information on loan amounts, maturities, rates, like most things about the loan, basically. And we use other data sources that I'm not going to go through now for the interest of time that are standard in the space. Okay, disclosure requirements. So I mentioned that by this point in time, by April of this year, you have roughly half the market being subject to the rule. You can see it from this figure. So most of these issuers are those that have issued recently or that go back to the bond market pretty often. That's like this black dashed line. And then the red line says that there's like some number of like small number of issuers that haven't issued recently that also become subject to this rule. What's important to know here is that the issuers that are subject to the rule now are the larger entities that have greater reliance on like the muni bond market. So that's all you need to know for now. Like we do more in the paper, but it's like it's not as important as size. Okay, so let's see the filings, how they've evolved since the implementation of the rule. So the rule was implemented, like I said, at the end of February of 19. And there have been since then a total of about 5,800 like filings that list obligations incurred since the implementation of the rule. And so since that time frame, you can see that most of the filings are voluntary. And so these are filed by issuers that are still not required or don't fall under the rule yet. And this pattern has reversed only last summer. So you see the solid line here, like is above the hash line in August of that year. And so I think what's striking here, like what was striking here to us when we started working on this paper, is that there have been only 2,200 of mandatory filings relative to about 13,000 issuers that are subject to the rule. And so this is really, really small. You expect to see way more action here because, as I showed you, bank loans, like you have renegotiations, you have things that change all the time. Even originations should account for more than this. Okay, so basically what we do in the paper next is we try to measure the information content of the filings. We detail, like we hand collect information from about 2,300 filings. Basically we like manually read through them. And so what we find is even though most of them like show you the amount, some of them like do not show information that's really key to like trying to figure out what you're getting into. And so about a third of filings, you don't have debt maturity or like the loan rate. The majority of the filings don't have a summary, which may make it really hard for retail investors to really figure out what's going on. And yet many of them exceed like hundreds of pages of like legal text. Okay, so let me give you this best case scenario, this example of a filing, which has pretty much everything you need here. So you have the lender, S&T Bank, you have the entity that took the loan, you have the amount, the interest rate, like the maturity, and you have other terms. But I just want to say here, this is the best case outcome. Most of the time, you don't see something as nice as this. Okay, so we also measured information content of the filings more formally through an event study. So we compute abnormal bond returns around like when the filings occur. And we split the sample here into four groups, which I'm going to show you on the next slide. So what you have here in the first three columns is the mandatory filings, and then in the last three columns, voluntary ones. You can see that our findings are driven entirely from the mandatory ones. So it looks like here that mandatory filings, they have significant information content. What's interesting also is that prior to the onset of the COVID pandemic, the market views this funding as negative piece of information, and this trend like reverses afterwards. So this is very key. So what does this letter finding mean? It means that like if you obtain funding in a time of stress, anything you can obtain funding with is a good news, like basically. So then these results come from the higher risk groups pre-pandemic, and then they come across the risk spectrum afterwards. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. And I'm going to go through some of the coolest part of the study, the last part, where we gain insight into whether there is significant under reporting of this type of debt. So So what we do here is we like identify major bank loan events from the Y14 data from the Federal Reserve. We have both the negotiations and originations, and we study these separately because, as I mentioned to you earlier, that because of like some ambiguity in the rule, the market could interpret that the rule only applies to originations. So just to show you like the main results here, for all events, we find that only about a fifth of like events that are likely like significant and reportable get reported, like with the red, like right here. So originations, you see higher like reporting rates, but still quite low. I mean, you only see about 46% of the bank loan events that should be reported getting reported. And just wanted to say here that the issuers that do not report, they're substantially like carry substantially higher risk than the issuers that do like report. Okay, so in the final slide here, I'm going to mention one of the first things we checked here is whether these agreements are material to like each entity, and we find that the vast majority of them are indeed. So the underreporting that we find is not due to that. We also check whether the underwriters could be some small underwriters that may not be able to like enforce the rule. That's not the case. We find that the vast majority of the issues that lead to continuing disclosure are underwritten by the largest banks out there. And so overall, we argue that it's rule ambiguity in line with lower issuer sophistication that may lead to like what you're seeing. So to conclude, we shed light on the effectiveness and the market impact of the recent disclosure regulation in the muni market. We showed that whenever such a disclosure occurs, it is likely to be like informative for muni bond investors. But we also find that issuers underreport significantly such claims. So overall, such claims appear to be a significant source of risk for muni bond investors. Thank you.
Ivan, thanks very much for that fascinating work. It's a great honor to have Emily Brock from the GFOA to discuss that. So turn it over now to Emily.
Thank you so much. And thanks, Ivan, for going through that with us. I've got to just say again to Dan and to Brookings, thank you so much for having me. But also thanks to Ivan, Tom, and Nathan for all the work that you've done for this paper. Just a little bit of background. I'm sure attendees might actually know about the Government Finance Officers Association, but we represent over 21,000 issuers of public debt. And I was able to read the paper through the lens of my members, the issuer community. And just a tiny bit of background about sort of how I approach it personally. The work that I do with GFOA is to advance issuer and industry initiatives that would enhance disclosures. Some of those things that we use are best practices. Other things, of course, we comment regularly on SEC and MSRB proposals to enhance the areas that we work in. And also, we host a number of industry initiatives, and one of those is a disclosure industry work group with the market participants. And so it's we think it's a collaborative approach is usually the best way to finding industry best practices to create a good experience and a better product in the end. So, but I did learn a lot from the paper. It was fantastic. I really enjoyed figure three, showing how much disclosure in each category, the timeliness and the consistency of the disclosures on page 16 and in figure four. But digging into the content of the paper, there's just a few overall kind of points that I'd like to sort of bring to the fore. First of all, data. And Ivan, you kind of went quickly through through your data discovery, but your data discovery is intense. Ivan and I had a chance to talk, and a lot of it was done by hand. And I think what we can do together, the industry, both the industry and of course academics, is we can use this opportunity to see what Emma can be. NERMSRS is 13 years in our rearview mirror. And Emma is now, part of our disclosure document a repository. It is our document disclosure repository. We work very closely with the MSRB to give them ideas on how they may be able to enhance the user experience for issuers and EMMA. When the issuer experience is enhanced, we bet that it will also be enhanced for stakeholders like academic community, but also others, you know, in the industry that may need this type of information to not have to do everything necessarily by hand. But we think that this is certainly looking at the difficulties that you had and the challenges in making the data happen. We communicate regularly with the MSRB about enhancing that. The other basic sort of overall arching notion that I kept thinking about as I was reading the paper is timing. You note in the findings that there's some possibility that there may have been some underwriters and maybe issuers who may not have been fully aware of the amendments when you were digging up the data on page 23 and then again on page 24. GFOA has a long-standing best practice that urged issuers to meet their CDA requirements, and information that is already developed within the government should be considered for voluntary disclosure. So prior to 15 and 16, we suggested bank loans become voluntarily disclosed. And then after 15 and 16, we became very quickly informative to the issuer and the issuer groups to make sure that they understood what that looks like. But I'd say over the past 10 years, generally, industry efforts have helped with voluntary disclosure related to pension disclosures and bank loan disclosures. I find it very interesting that there's sort of that uptick in disclosures that happened as you saw them. But I do think that there is another interesting way to sort of approach the paper. I think there's three different narratives maybe in it. The third overarching thing I did want to mention is on page one of the words that I was looking for and scanning for is the notion of materiality. Materiality is a major concept in our world. And you can actually, you read them in 15C212 and of course in event 16 and in event 15. Material means that you as an issuer are working with your bond counsel to make that determination. And I really didn't see a lot of influence of the fact that issuers lean very, very heavily on counsel to offer their opinions on that. And that intermediary effect may have some sort of exogenous factors on whether or not they will disclose or not. But now, on the content of the paper, generally, like I said, I saw sort of three papers in the middle of this. The first is the major question, Ivan, which is rule ambiguity. Does negotiations or restructuring debt belong in 15 and sort of your struggle with what constitutes a reportable event? But the GFOA, we have a long history of of making sure transparency happens in the municipal marketplace. And what we do is we say, we urge our members to disclose material events to the investors. So establishing that materiality is important to make sure that the relevant information is passed along to issuers. It's made on a case-by-case basis, and that if material qualification needs to be established before you establish key parameters. But for the purpose of this paper, or maybe even a normative exploration of the concept of materiality in another paper, I would suggest kind of really digging into that concept. Also consider, like I said, the players at the table. There are underwriters. They are held to the 15C212 standards. There's bond counsel. There is issuers, but there's also municipal advisors. There's a lot of people that sit around the table and make sure that those disclosures and those decisions are made. Less municipal advisors, of course, more bond counsel. Now, recently, GFOA has led industry efforts to educate issuers and encourage material voluntary disclosures on ESG matters. So there could be a notion here where if you do dig into materiality and it ends up being an important variable in making the determination of disclosing bank loans, we think that there's certainly an extension of that academic exercise to ESG matters, COVID impacts. There could be a lot of extensions from here. The second theme I saw in your paper was information content and complexity. You use the words informativeness of the disclosures, and you point to the boilerplate disclosures as a major frustration. And on the other side, missing or imperfect information, which is so important to us. It's very central to what we do. The MSRB plays a certain role in those boilerplate disclosures. So again, another person sort of at the table when they're having that conversation. But you know, from an issuer perspective, if it's boilerplate, you know, of course, then you are provided the protections of the words. It is certainly a different perspective from an institutional investor and a retail investor kind of looking at the boilerplate language, but we don't know that that's gonna go away anytime soon. So I would just make sure to sort of focus on the underrepresented information. The third paper, and I thought the most intriguing part of the paper, was your COVID-19 disclosures and information need during market ambiguity. Of course, that sort of juxtaposition, the yin and the yang of, well, before COVID, if you did disclose your bank loans, it was worse off for you than after. But then after COVID, you realize if you disclose those bank loans, the markets actually kind of appreciates that you have sources of capital and that you can get those. So I think that that really is in and of itself sort of its own paper. Certainly a conversation about the, I think really about the emotion of our market, that there people are certainly interested to know when communities are doing okay in a time of crisis, that's an okay thing. So I found that COVID-19 disclosure section to be especially interesting. And finally, the relationships that you discuss are extremely interesting to me. I think it goes a long way to answer the question about awareness and capacity issues of issuers to comply with these requirements. So Ivan, you and I talked offline about this. Data constraints, of course, are a challenge, but it may be interesting to look at different market sectors like independent school districts or others, smaller issuers, or even special purpose districts, and how not just credit ratings, instead a better understanding of the participants in the market and how they then have been able to interpret 15 and 16 and how they have been able to disclose in the wake of 15 and 16. You also start to explore this with underwriters, which I thought was very interesting at the very end, maybe suggesting that smaller underwriters may have awareness or capacity challenges themselves. But ultimately, you found that it's not really the smaller banks, that it's the bigger banks. And so I think that incidence of the disclosures is an intriguing sort of area that needs to be explored further. So I just want to say thanks again for the opportunity to review this paper. And I look forward to any questions from the audience, as I'm sure folks have many.
Yeah, thanks, Emily. And even I think you're there. Has Tom Zimmerman been included in this as well? I know he's somewhere in the building.
Tom is here. I see him on Zoom here, but I don't see him on the screen though. Here.
Tom has just been promoted, so I want to give Ivan and Tom the opportunity to respond, and then we're sure getting some questions in the Q&A chat. So do you want to take a moment each of you to respond to Emily's comments?
Yeah. So I just wanted to say this is extremely helpful. It would really help us improve the paper, and thank you for being so kind. Like the chat we had last week was super helpful. Like we already started to think about what we can do with Tom, like for the next iteration. I think exactly. I agree with you on all ends. I think we need to like explore this more. And I agree with you that materiality has to be like really upfront. We do work on it, but somehow we shove it at the end of the paper. So that's not how it should be. So we need to elevate it more. For the content of the filings, like I agree, I think maybe, like you said, it's like the wishful thinking that basically you have like simple summary for everybody, but I think it will be a big win if, say, everybody files. Other than that, I think like definitely, I think like one of the most important points that we need to address going forward is, like you said, I'm going to approach on that, who sits on the table, like the bond council, the underwriter, and then the municipal advisor. So we need to look at that, and we can look at that. Emergent has this information, so like we're going to be working more on this. So at this point, I'm going to give the floor to like Tom and see if he has any additional points.
Thanks, Emily, for the very nice discussion. I don't think I have much to add here at this point, but just to also say thanks, something on the materiality. I think Yvonne didn't really talk about this in the slides today, but we did do some work on that already. So we compared the undisclosed loans to the volume of these undisclosed loans to the volume of disclosed bonds. And we do find that often these undisclosed loans are in a similar ballpark, the amount of the most recently undisclosed bond of the same issuer. So it seems to be material in that sense.
There are some questions that are coming in the chat. And so I'll pose the first question, sort of the curator of the questions. We have a question from Dan Garrett, who I think a lot of people here know. Dan asks, have the new disclosure rules had an impact on the activities of credit rating agencies, or is private debt something that they were already accounting for? Is there any changes to the way that credit rating agencies are processing ratings with this new source of information?
So I can take this one. The agencies were already starting to count such debt into the riskiness of the entity. I think to the point where if they were able to observe such debt, they would incorporate it, but most of the time they wouldn't be able to observe it. And I think S&P had a statement in 2017 or 2018, and this kind of made its way to the Financial Times and Wall Street Journal, I think basically urging issuers to report voluntarily such debt, because if they don't, and if they find out that issuers had such debt, they're going to lower their ratings. But I'm not aware how they can enforce this, actually, if an issuer would never report it. And I think this case is severe, especially it's not severe for the smaller entities. I guess one way to find out is if you look at the annual reports, you can look at overall debts. And then I know that my GFOA has a separate rule there that requires such debt to be reported in the statements. I don't know how much information is reported there, but I think you can find some information there. So I think going forward, this could be enforced by both rating agencies and the underwriter.
And I'd say too, your credit rating agencies are definitely looking at parity and notions of where that new debt ranks. I mean, their analysis is how can you pay back your debt? And so that's their primary interest. So of course, bank loans does play a role, has historically played a role. And I think they were active in this discussion when the rule was being developed.
There's a question that's coming in the Slido session. It's an anonymous question. So an anonymous question here. And it basically boils down to the extent to which banks may be discouraging municipalities from disclosing the obligations. Is that something that you've encountered? And how is that playing out in your data? How's that playing out in the market? If banks are, twisting arms to try to keep this from being disclosed?
I don't think we can observe that. So I don't think we can say much to that end. So it's unfortunate, but we can't.
Emily, is this something?
In your paper, you discuss the redaction, and that certainly was a major part of the voluntary disclosures, that there was a lot of information that was redacted in order for banks to remain competitive with one another.
So I just wanted to mention on this end, you can almost never see the fees that is being charged for the bank loan. So that information is always missing. You can oftentimes not see rates like we showed with Tom. Reductions I'm not sure whether this comes from the bank, though. Like, it could be coming from the entity either, right? Like, so it's not clear, like, which side it comes from.
There's one last question, which has just come in from Kate Yang. And the question is basically, what are we seeing with state regulations? So think of California, where there are state requirements for disclosure. Are you getting any more information in those places? Or how does this play out differently in places where the states will force some disclosure versus places where that doesn't happen?
So I can take it, or maybe Tom can take it either way. I know I took like most of them so far. So Tom, like, would you like to do it? Or okay. So, okay, I can take like this one too. So basically, I like haven't looked into that. I know that some states have required it. I think two of the larger states, so you mentioned California and New York, also has pretty strong regulation on this end. So I looked at these data previously, and I think there's lots of information there. But I think the filings sometimes would include more information. Sometimes they would include like less. So it's not really clear. And then it's only two of the large states are requiring that. So that's clearly, not enough. For New York, I think there's pretty neat information. But I'm not sure if bank loans are fully covered or just at least in part covered. So I need to look into that more. But I think what's neat about their information is they have this reporting every year. So even the financial statements are like available up to basically now.
We've now hit the end of the time that we have allotted for this. I think it's been a great discussion. I hope everybody watching at home will join me in giving applause to everybody who's participated today. It's been so far a fantastic day. We're gonna take a 9-minute break. So we'll reconvene at 2:15. And at that point, David Wessel will lead what I think is gonna be a great panel on municipal disclosure in the COVID-19 crisis. And so I'm gonna mute and hide myself, and then when you come back at 2:15, David Wessel will be in charge and will be moderating that panel.
Good afternoon. I'm David Wessel, Director of the Hutchins Center. Welcome back to the 10th Annual Municipal Finance Conference. I want to thank my friend Dan Bergstresser for such excellent moderation of four terrific papers. We're now going to do something slightly different. We want to ask the question here in this panel: what do we know about how COVID-19 affected the finances of state and local, and particularly state governments? And we have three presentations from very different angles. First, in a nice segue from Ivan Ivanov's paper of a few minutes ago, Mark Jaffe of the Reason Foundation has tried to look at the municipal bond market disclosures about COVID using text searching to see what do we learn about what they disclosed. And then we're going to turn to some people who have a great deal of knowledge about what's really going on. Kim Merniks, who oversees the budget of the state of Ohio, and Brian Sigrets from the National Association of State Budget Officers. As many of you know, COVID was an extraordinary experience for all of us. For state and local governments, we went from the panic stage, where they thought their revenues were going to dry up, where a lot of them cut their workforces, to the federal aid stage, to then discovering in many places that revenues held up quite well, in part because federal aid to unemployed people in many cases was taxable, and in part because, unlike past recessions, the stock market rose rather than sank. So after we hear from Mark, Kim, and Brian, I'm going to be joined by my colleague, Louise Shaner from the Hutchins Center. See if we can get a conversation going. As before, if you have questions you'd like to pose to any of the panelists or just comments, please use Slido, SLI.DO, and you can go to #MuniFinance, and I'll keep an eye on that. So with that, I'm going to start with Mark Jaffe from the Reason Foundation.
Thanks, David. So we looked at how the MSRB responded from a disclosure standpoint to the COVID crisis. And it was actually quite impressive how quickly and how thoroughly MSRB addressed the issue of COVID disclosure. So about a week or two after the crisis started, MSRB started posting occasional reports showing summary information about COVID disclosures and then details of each disclosure. Ultimately, by the last report, which was earlier this year, there were a total of 14,000 primary market disclosures that referenced COVID-19 and over 40,000 continuing disclosures. So it was quite an immense effort. MSRB was able to leverage the work it had done in terms of text searching, disclosures that it's been collecting over the years and moving to the cloud. So it was quite a robust response in that sense. The problem is that when you're looking at 40,000 continuing disclosures, some of those are going to be more interesting than others. And in fact, many of them really just had boilerplate, as I'll show you in a minute. What MSRB attempted to do is to do a word count method of distinguishing between really important COVID disclosures versus those that might have just incidentally mentioned them. So they essentially looked at all the words in each PDF disclosure, identified certain keywords like COVID-19 or pandemic, and then counted those words and then established buckets, five different buckets for the word frequency, with bucket number two being the mode of this distribution. So unfortunately, when you rely strictly on word counts, things that are boilerplate can still get through. So here we're looking at Alabama's annual comprehensive financial report from 2020, where there were six references to COVID-19 or pandemic, but all of these references are really boilerplate in nature. So for example, the COVID-19 pandemic is causing economic disruptions. Long-term impact is uncertain. Not really news you can use as a municipal investor. On the other hand, you can get really dense disclosures. And this is from the OLAF Health Systems event-based disclosure in Kansas a few months into the epidemic. And you can see real specific information about rates of admissions going down, surgeries going down, overall clinic visits increasing, and then $3 million in COVID-related expenses. So this is when we think of a COVID-related disclosure and how it might impact the ability of a municipal borrower to repay. We kind of think of this type of disclosure, even though it might not necessarily do that well on the word count. So a couple of approaches to perhaps build upon what MSRB has already done. So in analysis that I conducted with my friend David Lucy, what we did is we looked at the percentage of words in the document rather than the raw number of words. And that's how this document here, the one from OLAF Health Systems, popped up into our top 20 list, because it had a relatively small number of words, but there were a lot of COVID-related words within those small number of words. So it's going to tend to privilege the event-based disclosures as opposed to the annual disclosures, which is probably about right for this. A more elaborate technique is used by an external vendor, DPC Data. And what they do is they have an analyst review all of the disclosures to determine whether it's really a COVID disclosure or whether it's something that mentions COVID parenthetically within a broader context. And you can see that they've released periodic reports that show the frequency of these disclosures. The last one ended in May of 2021. So what could we do maybe for the next crisis? Hopefully it won't be a next crisis, but it seems that crises are inevitable. So what if a market-wide crisis like this would occur? Well, first of all, as I said at the beginning, MSRB really has positioned itself very well in terms of having the entire corpus of text and the ability to search it. But as we've seen just doing text searches has limitations. And so right now, the best practice is to have a human analyst get involved. In terms of how we could potentially improve going forward, adding fixed fields, like a multiple choice or a fill-in response, like how much money do you think you are losing as a result of this crisis? Put fill in amount here. That could be something that would be much more easy for investors to analyze and act upon. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we have to replace the sort of text-based essay form, you know, free form kind of answers that we currently see on municipal disclosures. They could supplement it. And within those text-based or free-form disclosures, we could think about maybe tagging relative facts, which is something that Extensible Business Reporting Language used currently in the corporate sector and overseas could potentially bring to the party. And so with that, I will turn it over. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we have the great luxury of going beyond what happens to show up in disclosures to what's actually happening from somebody who actually had to make it happen. So, Kim, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what's it been like in Ohio for the last couple of years, and what do we know now that we didn't know before, and where are we going?
That's a sure. Yes or no question. Thank you. Sure. Thank you, David. And good afternoon from Ohio. I'm Kim Murnix. I'm the director of the state's Office of Budget and Management, and really happy to be here today to talk about Ohio's budget story over the past 18 months or so. It has definitely been a challenge, but it is a good story to tell. In Ohio, I like to say we tackled the pandemic head on, both from a health and a budget perspective. Governor DeWine made early decisions to protect lives, and so we are now in a position where we're able to make investments in our state's future, in our new state budget, because we did take those immediate actions early on to ensure that we remain balanced. And, you know, really started very early when we saw the pandemic, even before it was considered a pandemic, starting to affect China and Asia in early 2020. So in February of 2020, even before we had a single case in Ohio, we started what I call a soft hiring freeze in state government. So we knew at that point in time, or we had reason to believe, that even if the pandemic itself and the health effects were mainly affecting overseas, that would have an impact on our economy. Ohio has a global economy. If we were a country, we would be the 21st largest country. We're the 7th largest state in the nation, and we knew that what happens overseas would affect our economy, even though we were in a really good position in February of 2020. So we took those kind of early initial measures, slowing down state hiring, looking at our overall spending. And then in mid-March, at a point when our state general funds were still about $250 million over estimate through those first 8 months of fiscal year 20, we instituted several direct cost containment measures, including freezing state government spending. We instituted a contract freeze and a travel freeze for all expenses except those activities directly related to the pandemic. And we asked every state agency to put together a budget cut scenario at that point in time.
This is March 2020?
This is March of 2020. So again, very early on. Through the end of March of 2020, our revenues were still ahead of estimates, about $89 million still ahead at that point in time. But we continued to be proactive, and we took more measures to ensure that our budget would remain balanced, including executive order budget reductions in early May of 2020. So that was our April revenues that were hard hit by the pandemic. And so we were already prepared because we had asked agencies to put together reduction scenarios in March and April. So we were able to actually institute those reductions in early May. And then that put us on firm footing to close by June 30th with a balanced budget. We continued those proactive balanced budgeting measures into the uncertainties of fiscal 21 that put us in a position to kind of lead on the economic recovery. One of the things that we did in June of 2020 to set up fiscal year 21 was through refinancing state bonds. We did a major refunding and restructuring of $780 million in state debt in June of 2020, and that achieved $363 million in fiscal year 21 cash flow savings, and it was at an all-in true interest cost of 1.54%. That was the largest state general obligation issuance in our history and the largest that our Public Facilities Commission had ever transacted. It was also our largest transaction in state history underwritten by a minority business enterprise and a women's business enterprise serving as financial advisor. So that transaction really demonstrated that we are a strong investment. And in fact, when we were in the market, the transaction priced at lower yields than a higher rated GO issuer that was in the market on the same day as us. So that was, I think, you know, an indication to us that our balanced budget measures were recognized and that Ohio is continued to be seen as a strong investment. So we continued throughout fiscal year 21 to align our state government spending and staffing and all of our essential positions, continuing hiring restrictions. But because we had taken early action, we were able to avoid any major disruptions like massive across the board layoffs. We were able to reduce our staffing by about 1,500 employees across state government just through attrition and by managing our hiring processes throughout that freeze. And that enabled us to maintain all of our essential services. We also managed our federal funds very conservatively. So we used our federal coronavirus relief funds that were allocated through the CARES Act, not to kind of prop up state government spending, but to help our local communities. So we fully shared 45% with our local governments. We ensured that those dollars went into every community in our state. We supported schools with those dollars, virtual and hybrid learning, colleges and universities to keep our campuses safe. We provided relief to our hospitals and nursing homes and healthcare providers. And we provided economic relief to small businesses, those that were hardest hit by the pandemic, childcare centers. So all of this was to ensure that we didn't use those one-time dollars to kind of prop up state government ongoing expenditures, you know, artificially. So we kind of managed our general fund on the one hand while using those dollars to respond to the pandemic and to ensure that the expenses related to direct pandemic response were not borne by our state taxpayers, but were borne by those coronavirus relief funds. So all of those deliberate actions really put us in a position going into our current, what's now our current 12-day-old new biennial budget for fiscal years 22 and 23, which was just enacted by bipartisan votes in our legislature about 12 days ago. And that supports Governor DeWine's vision of investing in Ohio's future. It prioritizes health, renewing our communities and reigniting our economy. So continuing our conservative approach to budgeting, continuing to use one-time resources for one-time investments, but one-time investments that we know will pay recurring dividends into the future. So it includes $250 million for broadband expansion, $500 million for community revitalization, including money to demo old structures and to redevelop brownfields. It continues our successful H2 Ohio water quality program because we know the access to clean, reliable water resources is crucial for our state's long-term economic success. It also continues to invest the new recovery funding, the new state fiscal recovery funds through the American Rescue Plan Act into sewer and water projects in, across the state. We also continue to provide relief for our businesses that are hardest hit by the pandemic, including bars and restaurants, lodging, entertainment venues, and new businesses that had the kind of unlucky timing to start right when the pandemic was starting last year. We're also using our ARPA dollars to pay off our state's unemployment insurance trust fund advancement that we received from the federal government, so that is not a kind of hanging over our businesses and our economy. So we also have historic levels of investments in to our workforce, including money for both adults and high school students to get credentials for in-demand jobs. And we continue to support our schools. We have a new school funding formula that invests both in student readiness and student wellness, which is critically important as we move out of the pandemic, but also includes dollars and is a new formula to ensure that our schools are adequately funded going into the future. So all of these investments and kind of this whole story, I think, we think here in Ohio, that it shows that our approach has paid off and our fiscal outlook is strong. We're strategic and structurally balanced, and we're rebounding. So we are seeing unemployment rates that are lower compared to the nation. Our employers are hiring in every community. We're getting Ohioans back to work. And so, and also to close out fiscal year 21, which ended again just 12 days ago, our tax revenues rebounded. We closed that fiscal year $1.5 billion, roughly 6% ahead on general revenue fund tax revenues compared to our estimates for the year. So that's the Ohio story. It has not been an easy year and a half, but I think our example shows that strong, transparent, and conservative actions have paid dividends so far and will continue into the future.
So just, I want to understand on your last point. So fiscal 2021 revenues were 6% ahead of your projections.
Correct.
How did they compare to 2020? Were they ahead of 2020 or below?
They were ahead of 2020.
And is that because of conventional income taxes, or what was driving the revenues?
That's a great question. Our largest overages were in sales taxes. So both our non-auto and our auto sales taxes. I think, you know, we saw similar patterns to other states as the economic impact payments from the series of federal bills, three separate rounds of economic impact payments really did spur consumer spending both. And we also saw, which I think a lot of other states saw, a shift during the pandemic from spending on services, which Ohio largely doesn't tax, to spending on goods, which we do tax. So that benefited our sales tax revenues as well. But we did also see overages in our income taxes, just not to the magnitude of the sales tax. And so as we've projected and looked at the future, we have taken that into account. We've actually looked at some of those sales tax receipts essentially as one-time revenue. We want to make sure we're not being overly optimistic about what will continue. We've kind of built in that the impact of the various rounds of stimulus will wane. And so we've built our balanced budget based on all of those notions. And we passed a budget that maintains a significant carryover into 22 and 23 as a buffer against any potential future downturns.
Thanks. Okay, I want to remind people that if you have a question for any of the panelists or a comment, you can use the Slido, SLI.do, hashtag Muni Finance. And now I want to turn to Brian Sigrets. Brian, Kim gave us a great case study. I'm sort of curious what you see across the country. And I know you have some slides. And I should mention that Mark Joffe has a longer paper, which we've posted on our website, along with all the other papers for the conference and all the slides.
Great. Thank you, David. Hopefully everyone can see my slides all right. And I did this okay. Yeah, like David said, I'm Brian Sigrist. I'm the National Association of State Budget Officers. So we represent the governor's budget directors and budget staff from the 50 states, territories, and DC. So Kim is one of our great and active members, and not just because she's from Ohio. What I was going to do today was talk a little bit about what we've seen so far for states, the impact from COVID, the impact of federal aid, and then also talk about the outlook we see for states here moving forward. So what we saw for states, and a lot of this is going to dovetail nicely with what Kim was saying with Ohio's perspective. In the end of fiscal 2020, we saw state revenues significantly impacted that last quarter of fiscal 2020. The 46 states began their fiscal year on July 1st. So that was that April to June period of 2020. We did see actual revenue declines for the fiscal year in 2020, even though the impact was only felt in that last quarter of the year. So during that time period, we also saw states sharply reduce their revenue forecast for fiscal 2021. Some states reduced revenue forecast by up to 20%. But as we moved through fiscal 2021, we didn't see those revenue declines that we were anticipating. And there's several reasons for that. One was due to the federal stimulus measures that were passed. They helped to pump a lot of money into the national economy. And since state economies are so closely tied to what's going on at the national level, those also helped to strengthen state economies. Also, the federal aid that's provided to state and localities was beneficial. And, you know, if you look a little bit at the specific revenue streams, on the personal income tax side, what we saw was, by and large, this downturn impacted low-wage workers, and high-income workers weren't nearly as impacted, in some instances not impacted at all. And since most states, for their income taxes, rely more heavily on high-income earners, income taxes weren't as impacted as states were anticipating and weren't as impacted as we've seen in prior recessions. And the sales tax side, there's two things going on. Kim mentioned services, which most states don't impact it. That was the area where we saw more decline, and not in the goods, the physical product. And then also states' ability now to tax online sales has been beneficial in this downturn as well. But all that being said, all states were impacted by this downturn. They were impacted in varying ways and different magnitudes. We saw some of the hospitality and tourism states significantly impacted right from the get-go. Also some of the severance states that rely heavily on things like oil and natural gas. And even though that states have, you know, physical conditions continue to improve, they're not quite back to the levels where they were before the downturn. And I have a couple of slides getting into that a little bit more. First, most of these slides upcoming come from our spring fiscal survey of states, which was released a couple weeks ago in June. So this report looked at governor's budget proposals for fiscal 2022, and we'll be coming out with reports in the fall looking at enacted budgets for fiscal 2022. Here you can see some of the variations between what states enacted for fiscal 2021. So this wasn't governor's budget proposals. This is what was actually enacted for fiscal 2021 and what was recommended for 22. We did have enacted cuts in a number of areas for 2021, whereas in fiscal 2022, we saw increases in nearly all program areas. This slide looks at some of the strategies states took to deal with the impact from COVID-19. So even though the revenue declines weren't as significant as was initially anticipated, we did see states take various actions. Things like targeted cuts, different personnel actions, fund transfers, and those sort of things. So, you know, the states were impacted, and we did see states need to take different actions to help them negotiate and move through fiscal 2021 before the revenue started to improve. This looks at the number of states that made mid-year budget cuts, going all the way back to 1990, and hopefully you can see the end of this slide. It might be cut off here in this view, but then fiscal 2019, And we had zero states make mid-year budget cuts, which is the first time that we have had that going all the way back since we've been tracking this. 2020, we had 19 states make it. And in 2021, when we collected the data, we had 12 states make mid-year budget cuts due to a shortfall. It's interesting, if you compare that to some of the prior downturns, those levels aren't nearly as high as what we saw. Take, for instance, the Great Recession, but also the recession in the early part of the 2000s when the tech bubble bursted, which didn't impact state revenues nearly as much as the Great Recession, but we still saw 37 states have to make mid-year budget cuts in both those years. So I think that, you know, does show once again that, you know, how quickly state revenues did start to rebound, and also the impact of the federal aid that was provided to states. I think this slide's a good one to show, kind of showing what happened with revenues. So the first bar on the left, this is spring 2020 forecast before COVID-19. Green one is in the middle is fall forecast after COVID-19 and the pandemic began. And then the bars on the right are what we were seeing in governor's budget proposals for this year. So you can see that state revenues have definitely started to recover, but at least as far as when governor's budget proposals were released, state revenues of both fiscal 2020, which is now completed, and fiscal 2021, which just completed, those revenues weren't back to the levels that states were anticipating before the pandemic began. When we have final numbers for fiscal 2021, we expect those numbers to be a little bit higher. So at that time, it might start to come close to what states were originally anticipating, but at least as of now, revenues are still not back to pre-pandemic levels.
Brian, can you go back to that slide for a minute? I'm noting the footnote there. So when you do this survey, general fund revenues include federal share of Medicaid. Is that right? Only Ohio changed the way they count them, so Ohio isn't in here. Am I reading the note right?
No. So let me see. Ohio, which Kim can get in more into. Ohio has changed the way, at least for our reports, Ohio considers their, Kim, please correct me if I get all this wrong, but Ohio included their federal funds for Medicaid in their general funds category, whereas other states don't include it in their general funds category. So Ohio's been a little bit of an outlier on how they consider Medicaid for our reports. They always include a footnote. But overall, on general fund revenues, what we're talking about, general fund revenues are personal income taxes, sales taxes, corporate income taxes, gaming, and we kind of have that all
over. I got it. I just wanted to make sure I understood what was going on with Medicaid.
Yeah. And then we also have a separate report called our state expenditure report, which gets a lot more into detail on federal funds going to states, and we'll be coming out with a new one that in November. So on rainy day funds, we did see states use rainy day funds some over the past couple of years. They didn't use them to nearly the levels what we saw during the Great Recession, though. During the Great Recession, they were really drawn down. This time, we did see some declines, but we're already starting to see some states build them back up. From the Great Recession until this pandemic began, state revenue or state rainy day fund levels were at an all-time high, percentage-wise and actually dollar amount-wise too. So they came down a little, but they're already starting to rebound. So states are once again investing in rainy day funds. So I kind of talked a little bit about some of this at the beginning, but this is what we've seen since the fiscal survey came out. One other interesting thing about what we saw, and this kind of gets into the differences or reports as well. So since the fiscal survey only looks at general funds, these slides that I was showing was showing declines in state spending or budget actions in state spending, what's going on the state spending side. The federal funds component, we saw increases in 2021 and we're going to be seeing for the next several years. When governors were proposing their budgets for fiscal 2022, most of them proposed their budgets between December and February. So that was before the American Rescue Plan was passed. So they were actually, during the time when they were proposing budgets, they were anticipating declines in federal funds.
because most of the CARES Act money was already going to be spent and the American Rescue Plan hadn't been passed yet. But then after that got passed, and now what we're starting to see is states begin to allocate funding for the American Rescue Plan is we're not expecting to see declines in federal funds in fiscal 2022, many governors' budget were showing. And also the revenue outlook has continued to improve as well too over the past couple months as the economy has continued to strengthen. Some of the American Rescue Plan funds have started to flow, and also various other aids programs were extended. So state revenues have continued to rebound, and we're going to see vast majority, probably around 40 or some states are going to, at least we'll see revenues exceed projections for fiscal 2021. Then just talk a little bit about what we're seeing with the American Rescue Plan. I think what we're seeing so far is we're seeing states begin to allocate the funding. States haven't finished allocating the funding. Some states haven't allocated any yet. I think there's several reasons why it's, states are, haven't completed allocating the funding. One being that there is a longer time horizon with this bill than what there was with the CARES Act. States have until 2024 to allocate it. We've also seen legislatures more involved this time around than what we do with the CARES Act. And also final rule from Treasury about the uses of the funds and the guidance hasn't come out yet. They've released initial guidance, but they're accepting comments on their rule until July 16th. So I guess that's this Friday. And then they'll be coming out with the final rule. So I think we're starting to see states allocate some of the funding that are likely to allocate more funding as we continue through this fiscal year and also until future fiscal years as well. This will be a multi-year process. I think what we're starting to see, Kim kind of mentioned this too, for Ohio's overall budget goals is that we're seeing states continue to respond to the negative impacts on the pandemic and continue to provide relief to individuals and businesses impacted by the pandemic. But at the same time, we're also seeing states begin to focus on helping to rebuild the economy and to make investments in the future and to help the state grow moving forward. So we're sort of seeing this dual purpose right now of helping businesses and individuals impacted by the downturn, but also helping the economy to grow and move forward. With that, I'll turn it back over and just quick note, all of our reports are always available for free to download on our website. And if anyone ever has any questions, feel free to reach out to myself or anyone else on NASBO staff.
Great. Before I just turn to the panel, Kim, there were two specific questions that came in. One was, can you tell us what's happened to total state government employment in Ohio from 19 to 20, 21 and 22? And secondly, that looks like you're in your office. Are Ohio State employees in the office or working virtually or both?
Sure. So first of all, on the total state employment picture, 19 to 20, kind of pre-pandemic, pretty steady. We weren't really experiencing any major growth in state employees, not really in, it had been fairly steady for multiple years. I don't have the exact numbers going back, but we didn't have any kind of major changes either way. We, as a result of the hiring freeze and kind of the attrition, we're down about 1,500 full-time permanent employees. We did have some areas where we staffed up with temporary workers, for example, in our state unemployment office. During the really heavy months of unemployment processing, we did staff up temporary workers. But if you look at just the permanent total staff, we were down about 1,500.
That's going forward. Roughly how many people work for the state?
Somewhere around 50,000. Yeah, roughly. So going forward, I think we will assess what the future needs are. We have seen some efficiencies through remote work and kind of going paperless that I think we're all assessing what our future workforce needs are. And we may have some, you know, end up somewhere we're in the middle. I don't know if we'll get back to what that pre-fiscal year 2020 staffing levels were. If you look over time, Ohio had been kind of, and I think that's true of a lot of state governments, kind of declining overall total staffing as we have become more efficient. And I think we've definitely seen some more efficiencies that we continue to take advantage of and think through what will be the long-term service needs. So on your second question about are we remote working or in the office, we are phasing back into offices, but many agencies are looking at hybrid work plans. My agency, as an example, we a year ago, actually last August, when we were, you know, 4 or so months into the pandemic, we saw that our team, our folks who do a lot of processing and just working in the system, doing accounts payable, that type of work, were more efficient in a remote work environment. And they were actually happier as well. So job satisfaction was up. Unplanned absences, you know, call offs were significantly down. And so we made the decision, and those employees happen to largely also work in leased space at that time. So we made a decision a year ago to give up that leased space and analyze long-term remote work for that segment of our staff. And by doing that, my agency was able to save about $400,000 in lease costs each year. So as we are phasing back to offices, we're looking at hybrid for some employees. Some employees will obviously have to continue to, and then this I'm talking about statewide, those that are direct care service, sure. You know, they could never remote work. But a lot of us can, and a lot of, we've found a lot of efficiencies are achievable and a lot of long-term job satisfaction. But I will say, as we have been phasing back in, I personally like the camaraderie and seeing people in the office. So that has been nice.
Great, thanks. So I want to let Louise and Mark weigh in here with any questions to Kim or Brian or any just reactions. Louise, you want to start?
Yeah, so I have this sort of big question that you sort of touched on. So one of the questions that I've been doing some work in the state and local sector that we have is, by any stretch of the imagination, that federal aid, even before the American Rescue Plan, was likely larger by quite a bit than the revenue losses. And yet we saw these really large declines in employment, much bigger than in the Great Recession. So there was this kind of puzzle. One of the questions was, how big were the extra COVID-related expenses? You mentioned some, but when I think about like relative to your revenue loss, relative to your rate, have you used the whole, your allotment from the Coronavirus Relief Fund and all the monies that public hospitals and public education cost? So how do I think about that? And on net, you just save a ton of money from having employment so much lower.
I think that was to you, Kim.
Yeah, to you.
Sure. Kim. Yeah. So our coronavirus relief dollars, we our total state share, if you kind of subtract out the proportion, the 45% that we did pass on to local government, our total was about $2.5 billion. Of that, our Department of Health allocation was over $300 million. And then all of our other responding state agencies, about $400 million. And then the other amount, so we passed on about $300 million in economic relief, about $500 million in provider relief to, again, nursing homes, hospitals, et cetera, kind of the healthcare provider community. And then about $150 million to K-12 and about $300 million to our higher education institutions. So if you look at it, all told, the cost to state government between all of our responding agencies and the health department, somewhere around $1 billion of that 2.5, but the vast majority we did pass on to others, you know, whether that's schools or local governments, et cetera.
And do you have a sense that that money that was passed on to K through 12 and hospitals is spent already, or is it sort of money that's going to be spent looking forward as they come back from COVID?
So the relief payments were spent from the state treasury, and so we're not really tracking how, you know, it was kind of straight up relief. The dollars for schools and higher education, they did have to draw down as they had expenses. The vast majority of that, it has been paid out, but there are still some funds being drawn down.
Ryan, do you have any sense of how other states have handled the issue that Louise mentioned?
Yeah, no, it's a similar story for the CARES Act, the coronavirus relief funds. It was originally states had to spend it by the end of this past calendar year, 2020. Then it was extended to 2021. When we were looking at it at the end of last year, the vast majority had already gone out the door. So, you know, most of that has been, you know, by now. So now states are getting into looking at how they're using the American Rescue Plan funds. I think we are seeing, you know, as I kind of mentioned this in my presentation, a little bit of a shift in the use, whereas the CARES Act funds were much more aimed at using directly to respond to the pandemic and the public health emergency. And now we're still seeing that, but we're also seeing for other purposes, such as, you know, broadband or some of these longer term goals as well, and making needed investments to help the, you know, the state and localities well move forward.
You have a sense, let me just follow
sure.
up on that.
And Mark, yeah.
Do you have a sense of how long, like if we're thinking about what state and local government spending would have been over the next 2, 4, 5, 10 years, and then the American Rescue Plan, what's the timing of when that money is actually like making a difference in the state expenditures? Do you have a sense overall, Ryan?
I mean, yeah, I think we'll start to see the American Rescue Plan this year, where it's going to carry forward for the next couple of years. What I don't think we'll see, because of the longer time horizon, is what we ended up seeing during the Great Recession with the RR Recovery Act funds, where when we were looking at it, total state spending for states didn't actually decline until either fiscal 2011 or fiscal 2012. And that was due to the ARRA funds having winding down and the ARRA cliff, where at the same time, state revenues were growing very slowly. So we actually, during the Great Recession, the midst of the Great Recession, if you look at total state spending, we didn't see declines. We saw a decline in spending for state funds, but when you include federal funds, we didn't see a decline. And that was a couple years after where we did. I think this time around, we're unlikely to see that, since there is a longer time horizon and state revenues have started to recover more quickly than what we saw during the Great Recession. Of course, there's still uncertainties out there as far as variants and you know, other economic uncertainties. So you can't say for sure, but I don't think we're going to see something like that occur this time.
Thanks, Mark.
Yeah, sort of following up on this line of inquiry, do you think that that states, Ohio specifically, or any state, will be able to spend all of the ARPA money within the confines of the congressional restrictions as interpreted by the Treasury? Or do you think that some of those restrictions would have to be liberalized to make sure that the states are able to spend all the money that's being provided?
I can go. Yeah, I think that they'll be able to. I mean, you know, we've already seen states allocate, you know, fair amount. And some instances is, you know, they're doing larger chunks initially, and then, you know, examining further more targeted programs. For example, we've seen several states already put it through their unemployment insurance funds, repaying those loans. So
that's already been some large chunks that kind of gone out the door. And then we're seeing states set up committees and, you know, doing different ways of examining where the other needs will be best met. But, you know, there's some restrictions to the funds in areas like infrastructure being one. The bill specifically mentions broadband, water, and sewer, but then you're able to use it for infrastructure if it's part of your revenue loss. So overall, I'd say the bill is fairly flexible in its allowances and that states will be able to use it.
Thanks. You know, I want to make 2 points just that are obvious, but just on the table. One is, of course, local governments are much bigger than state governments. So some of what we describe about the state governments applies to the local governments and some doesn't. And the other thing I was just really interested, Kim, when you talked about just what a great opportunity it was for you to refinance the debt of the state of Ohio, which, as you say, is both testimony to the what the market thinks of Ohio, but it's a reminder when the Fed depresses long-term interest rates, that that's an additional boost to the state governments that sometimes gets put in a different basket, but you really helped us understand what it is. I don't see any other questions on the Slido thing. Louise, do you have anything else you want to ask? Because if not, I'm going to call.
I think we can. I mean, I have a million questions, obviously, but that's okay. I'll ask one quick question. Okay. We talked about employment. So I think the story you told, Kim, was very similar to what I've seen, which is that if you look at not employment outside of higher education, yeah, it went down a little, but not very much. It kind of was pretty flat. Higher education fell a whole ton. Like, and education fell a whole bunch at local, too. But even at the state, higher education fell a whole bunch. And do you have a sense if that's really just, we don't need people, nobody's on campus, and that's all going to just come right back up? Or is that a reflection of tight budgets?
No, I think it probably varies from campus to campus. We in Ohio did have students back on campus in the fall, but there were there was still a lot of online learning as well. Mm-hmm. And so that could have, you know, led to declining needs for staff at that point in time. I don't have a sense yet of whether that will be any kind of long-term trend or change. But I think that's like state government. I think all levels are and all institutions are kind of assessing how the, you know, what they learned during the pandemic about how staff can be more productive in different environments could lead to kind of longer term plans. So this disruption that we've seen, I think will have caused us to do some long-term assessments and long-term planning. And I can't really predict exactly where all of that will fall out.
Yeah, interesting. I think that's true for institutions with which I'm intimately familiar. I want to thank you all for a really lively conversation. And just to remind people, the conference will reconvene at 11:30 a.m. Eastern time, both Tuesday and Wednesday. Tuesday is going to be focused on some of the municipal bond market developments, and Wednesday will be focused on funding infrastructure. And then on Wednesday afternoon, as Dan and I have mentioned earlier, we're going to do a little experiment and see if we can come close to an in-person conference on virtual, which is to have an open session. Zoom links are on our website, one to discuss what's going on in the muni bond market, including such things as advanced refunding and Build America Bonds 2.0. And then the other one's going to be more like the conversation that Louise and Kim had on that. So with that, thank you all. I look forward to seeing people tomorrow. I'm told that we'll be muted, but don't talk until you get the all clear because you might be embarrassed on YouTube. Thanks.